The following podcast of the STR radio program is made possible through the generous support of our listeners. You can support this podcast by going to str.org and making a donation today.
Jim Wallace, Jay Warner Wallace, sitting in here for Greg Kokel again here at Stand to Reason. Looking forward to giving you a piece of my mind and looking forward to getting a piece of yours too as we talk about the most important things in life, ethics, values, and religion. So if you're just joining us in this first hour, which is for the most part local here to our footprint in Southern California, give me a call at 714 area code 754-4150, or you can call me toll free at 1-800-227-5278. Didn't think I was going to get here on time. The traffic on the way up here had a couple of accidents in front of me, but you know, we did it. Yes, it was close. I think I made Barbara a little nervous there as I didn't show up immediately, but we are in place now, looking forward to talking to you. And both Melinda and Greg are away from the microphone, away from the studio today. But I've got Brett Kunkel's beautiful wife, Erin, is screening all your calls. She is going to be the enforcer today. So give us a call at those numbers. That's right. And she'll do her best to make sure we get you on the air to talk about these important issues. Now, I just came back from a trip with Brett yesterday. We flew in late last night from the Smart Faith Conference in Phoenix, Arizona. It was a great opportunity to meet a lot of you who listen to STR Radio, who listen to my podcast, pleaseconvinceme.com, and it was just a wonderful chance to talk about the same issues that we often talk about on this show. And, of course, to sit and catch up with people who also do this kind of work, who we have a lot of fun with, like Frank Turek, Mike Lycona, and I'm sure Doug Powell, all the people we've talked, some of the people we've talked on the show here, as a matter of fact. We had Doug here just a couple of weeks ago. And so we get a chance to talk to Mary Jo Sharp. I mean, there's a number of people. I'm going to forget the entire lineup. I posted it on my Facebook page. But it was a great opportunity just to kind of catch up with them and see all the different work that they're doing and to see the kind of renaissance of apologetics that is occurring right now within the church. It's clear that as the issues of life and of ethics and of values and religion are being examined even from a hostile perspective by those who disagree with us, the church is rising up and developing its own response to some of the objections to Christianity. And I think we are seeing now a growth in renaissance and apologetics here in the church. So it's great to be a small part of that, just kind of ride that wave a little bit. And when you get asked to come and talk at a conference, they'll sometimes tell you what they want you to talk about, or they'll ask you to talk on a particular topic. And yesterday, as I was asked to come in and do a couple of sessions, I was asked to try to help the folks there develop a simple, shorthanded process, a system by which to describe why they believe that God exists, and to do it in a way that would be accessible to as many people as possible without having to master, perhaps, some of the finer or more detailed arguments of cosmological argument or the axiological argument, teleological argument. And you know what you notice when you go to conferences? You notice that we're all kind of examining the evidence from a different perspective. All the speakers come and they take a different slant, a different angle at the same pieces of evidence, and we talk about them and we argue through them and we try to anticipate any objections to these different pieces of evidence, and we try to provide our perspective on some of these pieces of evidence. And what's really great for somebody like me who's got a design background is we get a chance to see how these issues are presented visually. So, for example, to hang out with Doug Powell, who's a graphic artist, and he's done all the eyewitness, like the eyewitness resurrection app for the iPhone. I mean, he's just a really a wonderful artist, and to kind of see how he would present on certain issues is for me very, very educational, and I learn a lot from it. But I also realize that, boy, we can become dependent upon our visual presentations, can't we, when we're trying to describe the issues that matter most. So, if you were to ask us to talk about some of the evidences for the existence of God, most of us as speakers will bring along with us some type of media presentation. You know, we'll bring along some kind of PowerPoint. We'll bring along some type of media that we present to the group we're talking to. And what happens though when you're at a place where you don't have access to the media? What if you're talking to somebody who you don't have access to articles online, you don't have access to the videos on YouTube that you would love to show them to make the case even better than you can? What if all you have is you're just sitting on a bench and you've got a 10-minute or 20-minute window of opportunity to discuss the most important issues in life? You know, how would you begin to make a case for God's existence in that setting? That's where we most of the time find ourselves, isn't it? It's not that we can invite our questioning, skeptical friends to necessarily to a conference like Smart Faith Conference. It'd be great if we could. It's not as though we can always, you know, pop on a DVD and get them to sit still for 40 minutes while we watch a compelling presentation of a particular argument. Sometimes we've got to do it ourselves, right? We've got to just be able to sit still and offer something that's cogent, that is powerful and perhaps persuasive. But you've got to use the tools that are at your disposal. And this is exactly what happened to me several years ago when I was sitting with my dad, and I realized I had a window of opportunity to share what I believed about God's existence and why I believed it was the most reasonable inference from the evidence. But I was on a bench at an amusement park waiting for our kids, his grandkids, my kids, and my niece and nephew to get off a ride. And I knew I had a very short window of opportunity that would probably be filled with lots of interruptions and sounds and background noises. Not the best, you know, venue in which to share the truth about God's existence, but I wanted to take the time at least to make the effort, right? So I thought back to my experience as a youth pastor when I used to occasionally, 1 week or so a quarter, I would do what I would call like a cigar box illustration, in which I would take a closed box and some type of an object, and we would do an object lesson with my high school students to help them think through issues related to apologetics. And you have to be kind of creative to do this because you want to be able to use objects that make the point. And I started down a series of these lessons with my youth group, and I thought this is the kind of lesson I could actually use with my dad in this weird setting we're sitting in. But I don't have my box or the object that I usually would put in the box to make the point. But I did happen to have my wallet and a dollar or $5 bill, whatever it may be, in my wallet. So I thought, let me just try to make the case for God's existence using what I happen to have with me. And so I developed this idea, and does it have its liabilities? Of course. Anytime we're trying to create analogies or metaphors for some of these deep issues, they're going to have liabilities. You're not going to be able to, just like trying to create an analogy or a metaphor for the Trinity, right? It's not going to be easy. There will be some problems. You will get your hearer to take a couple of steps in the right direction, but you won't probably get them all the way home. And we understand that, and we know this is the kind of the nature of metaphors and analogies. They have weaknesses, and we have to just kind of say, hey, is it worth us making the effort to go forward, even though there may be an inherent weakness in the illustration? And so I think I'm going to offer this to you to see how you feel about it, and I'll kind of share a little bit about what I shared over the weekend with the Smart Faith attendees. And so for me, the illustration begins by simply taking the wallet out of my pocket and showing it to my dad and pulling the dollar bill out of the wallet and simply asking my dad, I want you to tell me where this dollar bill came from. It's in my wallet now. How did it get in the wallet? And of course, the first thing he says is what? He's going to say, well, you put it in the wallet. Okay, great. That's a good answer. And it's a reasonable answer. But what if I limited the answers that are possible to this question by saying you cannot go outside the wallet for an answer? You've got to provide me an answer for how the bill got in the wallet, but you've got to stay inside the wallet for the answer. And obviously, the fact that you're saying, or the idea, the answer that you're giving me, that you put it in the wallet, that's not going to work here because I'm outside the wallet. I'm automatically disqualified in the new system I put in place for you. You've got to stay inside the wallet for your answer. That's the limitations I'm giving you. Now, there are a couple of answers, I think, even if you had to stay inside the wallet. And he thought through those, I think, for a little bit. And I think there are a couple of answers. One, you could argue that the dollar bill has been in the wallet all along, forever. It's been in the wallet for as long as the wallet's existed. It is part of the wallet. It came with the wallet. Nobody put it in there. It just has always been there. It just is. That's, I think, one possible answer that stays inside the wallet in order to offer an answer. The other answer, I think, might be, though, that somehow this dollar bill developed over time in the wallet from something of lesser ingredients that are in the wallet. But those are really the only two options I think I see in terms of having to stay inside the wallet for an answer to, for how it is the dollar bill got there. And, of course, we look at those three possible answers now. One, somebody put it in the wallet. That's an outside answer. Or two, it's always been in the wallet. That's an inside answer. Or three, it's developed over time. That's another inside answer. Those are the three options, I think, the three possible explanations for how the dollar bill got in the wallet. But we've got to really think about this for a second. Which of those three seems the most reasonable? And I think as we look at what the dollar bill is all about, we can see that only one of those three is really reasonable. Number one, we can see that the dollar bill does contain some interesting specificity, doesn't it? I mean, it contains writing on the dollar bill that we understand to be information. It's not just data. We actually understand what it is it means. When it says federal note, we understand what it is that it's describing. When it describes key words on the dollar bill, we understand what that actually means. It has information we can understand. As I pull out my own wallet right now, let me pull out a $5 bill. I can see on the $5 bill that it says the United States of America. And that actually conjures up something in our mind, doesn't it? That's a piece of information. If I change one or two of those words, it'll conjure up an entirely different idea, wouldn't it? When it says in God we trust, I understand what that means. If it said, if I just change the order here, in dog we trust, it would be a completely different sentence, wouldn't it? You see, there's information, it seems to me, that's on the dollar bill. And we recognize that when we see information, this probably requires, as Stephen C. Meyer would say, an intelligent source. As a matter of fact, I think Stephen C. Meyer is right when he says that there is not an example anywhere in the history of science or the history of the universe in which information came from anything other than an intelligent source. So as I look at this bill in my wallet, I think there's good reason to believe that something of intelligence designed the bill. And then as I look at that, it seems to me that two of the three possible answers are less reasonable. It seems reasonable to me that an intelligent agent put the dollar bill inside the wallet more so than that it developed over time, or that it's always been part of the wallet. Wouldn't it be great if bills were always parts of wallets? We'd all be buying wallets, hopefully paying less for the wallet than actually is inside the wallet, wouldn't we? But, I mean, we know that's not a reasonable answer. And I think this intuitively, when I use this illustration with my dad, it helped him to see that it's reasonable for us to go outside the wallet for an explanation of what's in the wallet due to the nature of what's in the wallet. The specificity of that bill, the fact that to imagine it coming together over time without some to randomly come together over time from lesser materials, what's the first thing you would say if you said, well, I think it came together from ink and paper that was in the wallet? Really? Well, how'd the ink and the paper get in the wallet? That's the next question we would ask, right? And to me, this is very similar to what we do when we examine the nature of our universe. We know that there's something in the universe, and the things that are in the universe had to come from somewhere. The matter in the universe has to come from somewhere. And we can either stay inside the natural realm for an answer, and then we've got to figure out how all this material came from other materials inside the wallet. Or we can go outside the natural realm for an answer, especially if we see what we believe to be information inside the wallet. Then we have to say, well, where does information come from? For example, do we see information in the DNA code? And that's one of the things we talked about here several weeks ago. Is DNA truly information? That's where I think the battle will be going forward. Is the challenge will be, well, I challenge, but I think the skeptic's going to challenge that DNA is in fact information. Because if it is, it leads to only one conclusion, right? What other example is there of any information coming from anything other than intelligence? And it seems to me the idea that DNA is as informative is actually valid, given that it's more than just data that reflects the way things are. It appears to be information that changes the way things will be. It appears to be much like a recipe, a directive that tells the guides and directs the process of protein formation and all kinds of other formation within the cell. And if it's a recipe, it's very hard to see it as anything other than information, isn't it? So we'll have to do some time, I think. You know, people will be arguing about information theory and whether or not DNA really qualifies as information, but that's where I think the battle is. And all I use the wallet, the dollar, and the existence of God illustration for is to help people see that how much more reasonable it is to allow ourselves to look both inside and outside the wallet for an answer. Because most of us who have been skeptics in our past, myself included, have been so committed to philosophical naturalism that we would never look outside the natural realm for an answer. We've excluded all answers that are outside the natural realm. And when that happens, we find ourselves trying to explain the presence of what appears to be information, the presence of specified detail, of irreducible complexity, these kinds of things we have to explain within by starting inside the wallet. And you can see how silly that is when you bring it down to the small scale of the wallet and the dollar. And that, I think, helps us to at least take a step toward theism as we examine the idea that we've got that dollar is either going to have been there forever, the eternal nature of the universe. And by the way, I think we have good scientific reason to believe that the universe is not eternally old, that it has a beginning. And then we've got to ask ourselves, how does matter come from non-matter? And if we get into these ideas about quantum theory, in the end, it seems to me that everyone I've heard talk about this detail, even when we talk about the quantum theories that are offered for multiverse theory and things like this, it's not as though they're describing that something came from nothing. Those descriptions also maintain that something came from something. All evidence we have so far, all the evidence we can look at that we would agree on, the standard cosmological model today is still Big Bang Theory. That is still the standard cosmological model. And that model describes that everything came from nothing. Nothing meaning nothing. I think it was Plato that said, the things that rocks dream about, nothing. This is where I think we've got some good reason to compel us to look outside the wallet for an answer. And with my dad, it was just a first step I took with him. Now, does this bring us all the way to Christian theism? No. And of course, all this does is bring us to hopefully opening ourselves up to look outside the natural realm for some example, for some source of where all this complexity and information comes from. But I think the next question we have to ask is, you know, do we have a reason to believe that this force is personal? The force that puts the dollar in the wallet, so to speak, is this a personal force or is it just an impersonal force? If it's an impersonal force, many Eastern religions would seem to fit the bill. If it's a personal force, I think we limit ourselves to, we're moving closer and closer to Christian theism, right? And then, of course, the last step has to be, what can I use the wallet to go another couple of steps? Can I use the wallet to point to personal theism? Can I use the wallet to point to Christian theism? That's really, I think, our goal. And the talk we gave yesterday takes us several steps in that direction. Now, is it a perfect analogy? Of course not. But it was an analogy that got my dad, at least, I hope, thinking about this. And I think when I talk about it in the context of other Christians who are examining this issue, it does generate lots of discussion. And for more on this, you can go to pleaseconvinceme.com. It's in the theism section. It's called A Wallet, A Dollar, and the Existence of God. And you can kind of walk through three videos that I think will take you in three steps through using this analogy as we focus on what's inside the wallet and look for explanations that are not limited to the inside of the wallet. The same is true when we look at the evidence in the universe. I'm hoping to talk to you about this and lots more today on a beautiful day here in Southern California. Give me a call. It's 714-754-4150, 754-4150. And if you're in not in the area and you want to call in from using the toll-free number, it's 1-800-227-5278. We'll be back here in just 2 minutes at Stand to Reason.
Did God really say? It's the oldest temptation in human history, one that targets the authority of God's Word at its very foundation. Its modern rephrasing takes many forms, both in academia and in popular culture. Are the New Testament documents reliable? Have ancient biblical books been lost or suppressed by the early church? Are the words of the Bible just flawed human inventions? These questions introduce doubt at the point of contact between God and man, undermining the Christian's confidence in the words of Scripture. Even those secure in their affirmation of divine authorship must wrestle with similar questions. Did God really say to me? In other words, do the promises of Scripture apply to the individual Christian's life today or only to those originally addressed? How is one to understand and apply these biblical assurances? In this timely collection of essays called Ancient Words, Reflections on the Reliability and Proper Use of Scripture, Greg carefully addresses each of these issues, providing both solid evidence for the reliability of Scripture and a clear roadmap for how it should be read and applied. Greg's responses to these popular challenges to biblical authority will help reinforce your confidence in this trustworthy book. Go to Stand to Reason's online store at www.str.org and get a copy of Ancient Words or call 1-800-2-REASON.
Is there ever a right time to judge? What did Jesus mean when he said, "Do not judge so that you will not be judged"? I'm Brett Kunkel, and you can hear the answer to this question on my Bulletproof podcast this month. Download Bulletproof from iTunes or the podcast page at str.org.
Did you know that nearly a billion cell phones were sold last year? And every year, 500 million obsolete cell phones gather dust in desk drawers or end up in landfills. I want to tell you how you can transform your unused cell phone and even your used car from a natural hazard into ministry impact to equip Christian ambassadors by donating them to Stand to Reason. Old cars and cell phones can be turned into radio time, podcasts, and other training resources that can build a whole new generation of ambassadors for Jesus Christ. Think of it. Because of your donation, Christians just like you will be able to effectively share their faith and change the lives of others forever. Now, to donate your old car or cell phone, just call iDonate at 877-897-4273 or visit iDonate.com and search for Stand to Reason. They'll take care of everything for you and STR. Not only can you donate old cars and cell phones, but iDonate can help you with all kinds of non-cash donations for STR. Just call them at 877-897-4273 or visit iDonate.com. And thanks so much for making Stand to Reason's work possible.
Well, good to be back with you here. Jay Warren Wallace sitting in for Greg Kokel. We're about to continue or start our conversation about these important critical issues of life, ethics, values, and religion, as Greg is still out speaking. Boy, what an amazing month he's had overseas in Hungary, speaking, just wearing himself thin, enjoying, I'm sure, the travel and a chance to connect with all of you personally. And he'll be back on the radio. In the meantime, I'm glad to sit in here and stand in for him as we talk about the kind of clear-thinking Christianity, a view of life that's worth thinking about. And I want to give you something worth thinking about. And, of course, I want to be challenged by you as well. So give me a call, 1-800-227-5278. And let me go to the lines right now, and let's talk to Dave in Indiana. Dave, tell me what city you're calling from in Indiana.
Yeah, I'm calling from Valparaiso.
Valparaiso. Okay, I can see it up on the wall, but I wasn't sure how to pronounce it. Very good. Okay, so tell me what your question is today.
So I was calling about arguments for and against same-sex marriage.
Yes.
And I know that I've heard somebody phrase it pretty well. I think I heard it on SCR, maybe a SCR web, one of the blogs or something. It's not bigotry, it's biology.
Right.
Which I think really is good at nailing it down. But the thing kind of the counterpoint to that is to say, well, how do we respond to homosexual activity in nature? I don't know, the one thing that comes to mind is I think I heard somebody once say there are certain species where the males have significantly high sex drives during whatever season, and it's kind of that they reproduce, but it's kind of, you know, I don't know, that because of it there's more activity between males and females at certain seasons or something along those lines, and that seems to, so that would kind of be a counterpoint to the biology not bigotry argument, and I wanted to know what you thought about that.
Yeah, I often get this objection raised as well, Dave, where people will come in and say, hey, well, look, we see, if the argument is that this is all, it's not natural or not natural behavior, we certainly see it as part of nature in other species, where we'll see the occasional homosexual behavior in other species. So the question then becomes for me is, well, look, we see a lot of other behavior in other species. We see there many times, for example, when other species will resort to eating members of their own species, a kind of form of species cannibalism. Okay, so the issue is not whether or not we see this behavior in other species. The issue is that behavior normative? And does that behavior assist the species in thriving? I mean, in the end, most of our skeptical friends, right, are going to come to us and say, hey, we believe in a process. We even believe that morals have evolved over time because we believe these are principles we've accepted and adopted because they help the species to thrive. Well, can you have it both ways? I mean, this is a, there are behaviors we see in nature as well, all kinds of behaviors driven by all kinds of circumstances and geographical circumstances. And the question we would have is, okay, are those behaviors normative behaviors? Are they kind of fringe behaviors that are part of the species but don't necessarily attribute to the thriving of the species? We want to know not so much are what – I mean, we see in our own – culture, right? We see a certain percentage of all kinds of behaviors. There are some people who are, there's always going to be some percentage, for example, of sociopaths in any in any group. The question is not, if there's a behavior that seems to be part of the natural structure of a species, should we do one of those things we talked about a couple of weeks ago? Should we agree as a group that we are going to prohibit, permit, or promote certain behaviors?
Mm-hmm.
This is what it comes down to. So while we might say that, you know, certain behaviors we would certainly permit, but are we going to promote those? In other words, want more of this, whatever this is. And this is one of the reasons why I'm a little, for example, I'm hesitant. I mean, of course, I've got a background as a police officer, but I am hesitant to take a very libertarian view about narcotic use. Do I want to permit even more? Because when you permit it, you're just simply going to say we accept, we want more of this, or we certainly aren't upset if there is more of this. So I've got to ask myself if you know, heroin use right now is prohibited. If I had to permit heroin use, I can guarantee you its use will go up. Is that better or worse for us as a group? Is, you know, we could argue, well, you know, if people aren't stealing to support their heroin addiction, then maybe we're okay. Really? Do we think that a certain percentage more of people who are loaded on heroin is good for us as a group? Does it help the population thrive? I mean, I think there are some things we have the obligation and I think the right to say we want to either prohibit these, permit these, or promote these. And so what we're saying here is we're not making taking a stand. I don't think I've ever taken the stand where I want to prohibit some behaviors altogether related to same-sex relationships. And that's not really our stand as a group. I'm not going to convince people to accept what I believe to be true in this area by clubbing them toward this truth. I've got to woo them toward this truth. So I'm willing to permit some behaviors as a matter of choice, but I certainly don't want to promote certain behaviors. Now, within the group of believers here we call the church, I think we have a whole different way of approaching this. But when I'm talking to my non-believing friends, I want them to understand that there are these three categories, prohibit, permit, and promote. And I would not want to promote there's lots of behaviors amongst species that are in the natural realm that we would not want to see that species promote. It wouldn't even be good for that species to promote that particular behavior, even though we see all kinds of behaviors in the natural world. So that's my approach, is always to look for another example of behavior that appears to be fringe behavior in the species and point to that and say, well, okay, if this is another fringe behavior in the species, so should we accept that behavior in our species if we're going to kind of make a parallel to the homosexual behavior? Should we accept cannibalism to a certain degree within our species if we see it amongst other species in nature? I don't think that's a good enough reason for us to embrace it here, especially if the naturalist himself believes that most of the moral decisions we make are made because we've accepted a standard of moral behavior simply on the basis of whether or not it allows the species to thrive. And I always wonder what that really means, right? When you say, what do you mean by thrive? Do you mean survive? Is it about survival? Or is there some qualitative word people use when they say they want the species to thrive? And that's what this whole discussion is about, right? So for me, when I'm talking to my non-believing friends, I do stay in these lanes that I've set up for myself that really talk about those behaviors that governments prohibit, permit, and promote. Then I take time to talk about the advantages that children receive from two biological parents. This has nothing to do with sexuality. It has to do with biology. It has to do with the biology of the relationship between parents and children and how powerful that is. Go ahead.
I just wanted to bring up kind of a counterpoint, kind of more specifically from the discussions I've had.
Okay.
So the people I talk to are kind of, they believe in a God, but it's kind of this vague kind of thing. And so what they said is, homosexuality, well, God made me this way. And so the point they say is they say, okay, so you believe in Adam and Eve and the creation, and then Adam and Eve sinned and it caused the fall. Well, and that the world was perfect and sinless before they fell. So if homosexuality is a sin, why is that not just only occurring in, if it would seem to say that that should only occur in humans and not in other animal species, because it was Adam and Eve who brought the sin, not, you know, not a dog or a giraffe or a donkey.
I do think we see other some of the sins that are common to humans, we do see in other animals. I think if you've got two or three dogs in your house, you've probably seen acts of jealousy or acts of of pride within the group of three dogs. I mean, we see other elements, that other behaviors that we can attribute to similar attitudes, state of the heart, basically, of that species as well. And I look at this and I say, there's always this, I think, this tug of war, Dave, isn't there, between, you know, how much of this is my biology, how much of this is my natural, you know, inclinations, how much is this the way I've been raised in my environment? What's the percentage in which all these things, three things come together? I never argue with people who say, you know, I feel naturally inclined in this direction. And, you know, there's something about my biology which seems to command me in a certain direction. I know that there are things in my biology that which command me in a certain direction also. I know if I could believe in a God that would allow certain behaviors, I would quickly embrace them. I would quickly embrace a form of sexuality that had much less guidance. I mean, most men, if you listen to Dennis Prager, I think you'll recognize that most of us struggle with fidelity. We struggle with monogamy. Yeah. We struggle with a sexual desire which is beyond the limits that we know we ought to embrace. This is, I think, the nature of who we are as people. There are lots of things. At the very least, I know I struggle also with impatience. On the way I'm coming up here, right, and I'm stuck in traffic, and I'm panicking that I'm not going to get here in time for the show. And I know, and I'm thinking to myself, how funny is this? I'm coming to do this show to argue for the Christian worldview, and now I'm truly being tested to live out Christian principles as I'm stuck here in this traffic, and I'm not really doing all that well. So I'm thinking to myself, this is just the nature of who we are, right? But we're talking about the is-ought problem. Yes, this is who I am.
Yeah.
But I want to know, who ought I be? Who should I be? Mm-hmm. What should I be? And so there's lots of is I could just rest in and enjoy the is that I am, right? I could enjoy the mess that I am. But I think we're called to something more than that. And I think no matter who you're talking to, they will at least agree there's some aspect of their life where they want to be something they're not now, and they realize they should strive for it. And by the way, Dave, I love it when people will say, you know, I believe in God, but not your particular God, not really any particular God. And you can't really pin them down. Well, you know, what set of scriptures is the set of scriptures you would accept as kind of the guidelines for your perspective on God? And most of them would say, well, I don't really accept it. You know, here's what it comes down to. They want a version of God which endorses anything they already believe.
Yeah.
That's the best God, right? The one who agrees with who I am today. Because it requires nothing of me in terms of transformation. It requires nothing of me in terms of commitment to change. I want a God who makes no demands on me. Well, wouldn't that be great? And that's where I think most of us kind of want to run to that version of God. And so if whatever I am today, how far can we draw this line? What if I'm okay? What if I said, we see this all the time on college campuses now. I was just at this conference over the weekend, and Frank Turk did a great job of kind of running through all the classes that are offered nationally. And some of the classes that are offered nationally in the university setting would shock you. Many which make a case for the legalization of pedophilia. So if this is my inclination, if I said, hey, you know what, I'm really inclined to be a pedophile, is it okay for me to run in that direction? I've always been this way. Could you make the same argument? Could you make the same logical argument for pedophilia that you would make for any other sin that you just want to embrace? Do you see how all of us draw the line somewhere, don't we? We would say, well, yeah, my sin's okay, but that sin's not. My behavior is okay, but that behavior is not. And so I think the battle for us is to argue about, well, where's that line? And more importantly, what's the ruler we're going to use to measure ourselves? Are you and I our own ruler? If that's the case, wow. Anything goes, right? I mean, that would be a sad situation, I think, if in fact that was the case. So I think that's kind of my approach to looking at the nature of who we are as a species and allowing it to dictate what we ought to be. Yes, it is how we are, but it doesn't mean that we ought to be that. I think most of us, when we're raising our kids, we look at our kids and we are very comfortable with explaining to them, this is how what you think you want to do, this is where you are right now, but let me help you get to where you ought to be, because that behavior is not proper. And we do this all the time with our kids, but when it comes to our own behaviors, we're less likely to do it, and we're more likely to kind of push others away who try to do it. So I hope that helps you a little. What do you think, Dave?
And just to kind of clarify my thought process on what you just said, I think it's a really good idea to hone in, like you said, on well, are there things you wish you ought to do and wish you ought to be better? And then I guess the counterpoint I'm seeing is that, okay, so homosexuality exists in other animals. Is a crocodile your standard? is the animal kingdom your standard? Is that really what you want to measure yourself up against? Along with that, I am kind of struggling mentally, and it's something I want to file away and think through later about sin entering the world through a human and then exhibiting itself in the animal kingdom. I still want to think through that, but at the same time, on the particular topic, to say, well, what is your plumb line? What are you measuring up against? And the animal kingdom is a pretty shoddy plumb line.
Well, it's interesting. I think you make a good point. I think that we attach sin to the human species for a reason. And we don't attach it to other species. In other words, we don't. If a human does a certain act, we would hold him accountable for the human doing that act. Mm-hmm. If your dog does the same act, we don't hold the dog accountable in the same way, because we recognize mm-hmm. that the human has the ability to make moral decisions that is unique yeah. to the human species. So when we look at moral claims about what is right or wrong, what is sin, what is morally wrong, that's something that these are decisions that only humans can make. So I'm not surprised then that sin enters the world through a human, because it's in the distinct nature of humans to be able to make these kinds of moral decisions. And we don't hold, when we see a whale, a killer whale hurt its trainer, we don't look at it like in terms of, well, what moral crime has the whale committed? As a matter of fact, we typically say, boy, you know, maybe we should have been more careful, because this whale is just acting within its nature, and it's incapable of making moral decisions, right? So I think this is what we have to be careful about, is that, yes, I can find behaviors in my dogs, jealousy and pride and all those kinds, but I don't hold them morally accountable for those. I don't consider them to be sin. I just am seeing behaviors in my dogs that are, I see also in humans. But they are unique in humans in the sense that we ought to know better. And this is why I think you make a great point. Yeah, we should not look to other species that have no capacity to make moral choices like this in order to find a standard by which we can make our own moral choices. That's just silly, because we're in a different box. We're in a different category from those other species. So I think that's a great way to put it, and I would just kind of flesh it out for him and say, hey, it seems interesting to me that you assign to other species the ability to make moral choices. Do you really believe that's true? Because if you do, why don't you hold, why don't you prosecute your dog when he steals the food from his, from the neighbor, or he chases the neighbor's cat or harms the neighbor's cat. We recognize that they're just acting within their nature, and we kind of give them a pass because they're not able to make those kinds of choices. So I do think it's important for us to be able to make the case like you just did. And I would simply ask them why they have that standard, which they would even in some way equate to the human idea of making moral choices. That really is a silly standard and a silly way to kind of compare the two, don't you think?
Yeah.
Okay, very good, Dave. I appreciate you calling in with that question. I'm going to try to squeak in, at least start with Dan here in San Diego. Thanks, Dave. I appreciate it. Let me start with you, Dan from San Diego. Thanks for calling.
Hey, happy Sunday.
Hey, thanks so much. If we get caught halfway here and we have to take a quick break, I'll come back to you after the break. So go ahead.
Great. Well, I was really, really enjoying your conversation with the other guy. Here's the genesis to make a pun of sorts of my question. I was reading a blog that Pastor Tim Keller out of New York had posted. It was a speech that he gave talking about Genesis and talking about evolution and some of the issues involving that.
Okay.
And in the context of that, he basically said, look, the second law of thermodynamics, which posits that systems will ultimately degrade and not, in fact, improve over time, the second law of thermodynamics is typically used as an argument against evolution, but, in fact, it can't be used because it's supposed to be within a closed system, and since we get sunlight from the sun to heat our system, therefore that argument goes out the window. And I found a British snarky unbeliever who made a number of comments like that as well. And I was curious if you had a take on that, and if there was a way of getting getting to it. I read a lot of Hugh Ross and really appreciate the astrophysicist approach to all the believer astrophysicist approach. So I'd like your take on that.
Yeah, you know, that's a great question. I was going to actually point you in the same direction toward reasons.org. We just spent the weekend. Jeff Zwernick was actually at the Smart Faith Conference with us. He's one of the astrophysicists that is on the staff there at reasons.org and a really smart guy. And I think I might have mentioned this last time. Either on this podcast or mine, I get lost in how many podcasts we're doing a week. But I can tell you, I remember sitting with him at a conference we did called the Truth Is Conference a month ago. And he was describing these issues. And it's not long when astrophysicists are talking to you before you start to kind of glaze over and go, oh, my gosh, I'm lost. I'm not even sure where he is. Well, I'm comforted, of course, by the fact that people who are in the know on these issues and are familiar with them have done the heavy lifting. And so I'm able to see them as expert witnesses. And then I'm able to kind of say, well, look, I've got to be able to re-communicate that both for myself. I've got to understand it myself. And then I've got to find a way to translate that for the jury, right? My friends and my family who have these same questions. And I think it does come back to the issue of a closed or open system. So what is the open or closed system we're talking about? And I think most of the time when the second law of thermodynamics is used, it's used in the understanding of the universe in total as a closed system. Instead of the biosphere here of the planet, is that the closed system we're talking about?
Right. That was my instinct, was to go there.
Yeah, and I'm not sure that – and I don't want to – again, as a cold case detective, I'm going to be outside my area of expertise here real quick. So I never want to overspeak the issue. But I know when I've kind of heard them talk about this issue and Jeff talk about it with me, that's really where the rub is that we're looking at – typically they'll come back to the system that is more central to the planet to talk about issues related to what's happening here on this planet. So I do think that I don't use the second law of thermodynamics as an argument against evolution. I look at the second law of thermodynamics as a piece of a circumstantial case that it points to a universe that has a beginning. That's where I think the power of the argument is. And I think it can only do so much for us. And I've never tried to look at the second law of thermodynamics and try to figure out how to incorporate it into an argument against evolution. But I do think we can use the second law of thermodynamics in the context of the system of the entire universe to argue for a universe that has a beginning. And again, we're going to take a break here. But when we come back, Dan, I want to kind of go through that with you a little bit. And I also want to talk about how we assemble a circumstantial case for the beginning of the universe and how that second law fits into that assemblage. You know, that's important. So we'll take a break here. We'll come back in 2 minutes right here on Stand to Reason.
We are ambassadors for Christ. That's what Paul tells us in 2 Corinthians 5:20. An effective ambassador has three essential skills. First, an ambassador must have the basic knowledge necessary for his task. Second, this knowledge must be deployed in a skillful way. There's an element of wisdom, a tactical and artful diplomacy that makes his message persuasive. Third is character. His personal maturity and individual virtue will either make or break his message. Stand to Reason's mission is to help you develop the foundational skills in each one of these areas. In Essential Ambassador Skills, Greg Kokel will train you in all three of these areas to be an effective ambassador for Christ and to represent God's message of grace in a broken world. To order this unique message, call 1-800-2-REASON or go to our website, str.org. 800-2-REASON or str.org to order Essential Ambassador Skills by Greg Kokel.
Do you want to know the one question I ask same-sex marriage advocates when they claim that homosexuals don't have equal protection under the law? To find out what it is, download my podcast, Thinking Out Loud, from iTunes or the podcast page at str.org.
In the United States, over 51 million abortions have been performed since it was legalized in 1973. That's one abortion every 26 seconds. If you have been wanting to be able to speak out effectively against abortion, or just be better prepared to discuss this often heated and always emotional topic, STR has a great resource to help equip you to do that. Stand to Reason Interactive, Making Abortion Unthinkable, prepares you for any pro-life encounter, from one-on-one discussions to a public debate, with the confidence that your case is solid, your knowledge deep, and your argument just. Created to be used as a personal study or in a small group setting in your church or home, this easy-to-follow, well-reasoned, plug-and-play course provides the basic training for anyone to become proficient in the art of pro-life persuasion. Through video, workbooks, role-playing, and quizzes, Making Abortion Unthinkable will prepare you to Restore meaning to the word abortion using compelling visual aids. Simplify the abortion issue by focusing on one strategic question. Present scientific evidence to offer a sound, reasonable, and persuasive argument. Expose the four common flaws of pro-abortion rhetoric. Clear the red herring objections and stay on course. Be respectful toward the person you're talking with. If you haven't yet taken a stand against abortion, call Stand to Reason today at 1-800-2-REASON. That's 1-800-2-REASON. Or visit us on the web at str.org.
Well, here we are back at Stand to Reason. Jay Warner Wallace sitting in for Greg Kokel. Thanks for joining us today. Music. Is that a switchfoot? I can't think of it. Maybe it's, surely that is. I like it though. Give us a call here at 1-800-227-5278. We happen to have a little room in our queue, and we might be able to get you in before the end of this hour. You can call us at 714-754-4150 also, but 1-800 is better, I think. Cheaper for you, probably. 1-800-227-5278. Let's go back to Dan from San Diego. We're talking about how to kind of look at the evidence from the second law of thermodynamics and how does this work and what way should we use this evidence, I guess, is what it comes down to, huh, Dan? And
that's,
I guess,
right,
from your perspective, I have also heard what you hear, which is that when it's used to argue about evolution on the planet, that this is not a powerful piece of evidence in the sense that we're not dealing with the closed system. And how, and I've not used it in this way. I think it's a powerful piece of evidence for the beginning of the universe. And I guess if we look at the context of how life has to come to be in a universe that is completely naturalistic and does not recognize the existence of a God or creator God, then I do think that the beginning of the universe is intricately tied to evolutionary theory. It is that kickoff that starts the game, right? How does matter come from non-matter? All of those issues.
The creation of something out of nothing, I think, is the ultimate question that I drive people back to. Well, you know, if there was a beginning and there was nothing that predated that beginning, then we have to start there. And if we start there, then what was the force that created all of that? On the evolutionary side, you look at the system and you say, how does a mutation actually help a genetic code improve? And I don't know that there's any proof that actually has happened anywhere. And yet that's the assertion of evolution, that over time, giraffes will grow longer necks because they'll be able to get their food. And the weaker, shorter neck ones will die. It's silly on its face when you really dig into it. But I agree with you that on a macro universe basis, that I love the second law of thermodynamics because the whole system is basically running down,
right,
not up.
It's this kind of idea, this simple idea, this intuitive idea that we all recognize, that heat does not flow spontaneously from cold stuff to hot stuff. In fact, we know that hot objects dissipate their heat right into the surrounding environment. They become,
right,
cold. And I think we recognize that any system that is free of external influences becomes more disordered over time, and that disorder is expressed in terms of this quantity or this nature we call entropy. And this is where the universe, we're looking at it and saying, is the universe a kind of place that is free of external influences? Is it a closed system? And if it is, then we are going to see entropy. And this, I think, is this kind of idea that things are winding down and moving toward disorder, toward a heat death. This idea that things are winding down is something we can play in reverse. And as we play it in reverse, we see that it seems to indicate, even on its face, this one little piece of circumstantial evidence seems to indicate that we're living in, for lack of a better way of expressing it, a wind-up universe, in essence, that is, by implication, has some point in the distant past where it has not yet been wound or it has not been released. This winding has not been released. In other words, we have to ask this question, what wound it up to begin with? So even if we had no other evidence, but the nature of circumstantial evidence is such that we want to go beyond that, right? We can't make a case, and I don't think anyone who would use the second law of thermodynamics either to make a case for evolution or to make a case against evolution would say that this is one piece that in and of itself, by itself, really says much of anything. It just points us in a certain direction. We've got to look for other things that either continue to point us in that same direction or maybe point us away from what we thought was true, and follow those things where they point. So I look at that and I say, okay, I look at that. You know, there's lots of – I've been searching during the break here, Dan, while I've been on hold with you here. I've been searching just to see it's at reasons.org, which is a great site we've been talking about, Hugh Ross's website.
Yeah.
At one time he had a list of all the current evidences from a number of different scientific disciplines which support – the standard cosmological model of Big Bang Theory, support the idea that everything came from nothing at a point in the distant past in which all space, time, and matter had a beginning. And these are, I mean, they're growing and growing. And I try to keep it simple, stupid, and really talk to my friends and family about just the ones that I think they can get their hands around easiest to make a case. And I do believe that even a short list is powerful. I think you. What do you think? I mean, as far as
I try to talk to people because you know everybody who's in potentially say a non-believer. Everybody's heard of Einstein, and in some way they revere you know his knowledge and his brain power and whatever. And I say you know they've tested Einstein's theory 18, 19, 20 times using both satellites and ground-based instrumentation and what have you, and his predictive power in the theory of relativity has proven to be spot on. Each and every single time. And so if that's the case and the Big Bang is a part and parcel of that whole general theory, then you go back and you say, there had to be a beginning. If there was a beginning, then you have to ask yourself, how in the world did everything come from nothing? And it could only be from someone who was, you know, a being which was omnipotent and which was also supernatural because he had to be outside this system that we call the natural system. And you get people thinking in that direction, and then they go, oh, wow, I didn't know that.
And I think, yeah, even the case, I think, for the expansion of the universe that you talk about with Einstein. I mean, it's not as though Einstein develops a theory, and that theory goes untested, and that theory goes unverified. I mean, right away, even in the early 1920s, you know, his theory, his special theory, is developed around 1905. But in the 1920s, you've got people like Alexander Friedman, who was right. a Russian mathematician, right? And he's using Einstein's numbers. He's using Einstein's theories. And again, he comes to the same conclusion. We were in an expanding universe. Now, this is important only in the sense that if you run the expansion backwards, you again come to the conclusion we've got to have a point at which everything begins and begins to expand. But
right.
he's not alone. Even before 1930, there were several people who affirmed the work of Einstein. Vesto Slipher, who's an astronomer, he also, in 1914, did a lot of work where he's showing how the nebula of the universe are receding away from Earth. And then, of course, that work led to Edwin Hubble doing the work he did, where he's actually looking at these galaxies composed of billions of stars, and he's proposing the law that we now know as redshift. So this idea that we use, and boy, do we use redshift or what? I mean, and yeah. today, cosmologists and astronomers are still using the same theories that were developed by Hubble. And that, so again, you have lots. It's interesting when you have four or five pieces of evidence that point to the same conclusion. I would suggest that the second law of thermodynamics, the expansion of the universe, the radiation echo we see in the universe, mm-hmm. and even from a philosophical, non-scientific perspective, the philosophy of infinite regress. These things come together to form a case. And interestingly, each of these pieces of evidence are also substantiated by another series of circumstantial pieces of evidence. So, for example, if we're looking at just the issue of the expansion of the universe, we do look at Einstein's work, we look at Friedman's work, we look at Hubble's work, and they all affirm the same conclusion. So what we end up doing is building this pyramid of evidences, starting with all these pieces that seem actually in some ways to be not even related to each other. And they all come together and point toward a singular conclusion. And in this case, the conclusion I think they point to most reasonably is that we're in a universe that had a beginning. Now,
right.
I think what to be careful about, Dan, as you and I, is that we have to kind of argue with our friends probably a little bit, and you may disagree with your friends about how long in the past that beginning began. You know, how old is the universe we're in?
Well, I was just going to go there because I've had that discussion with people, you know, who are literal 24-hour Genesis people. I'm sorry, literally, yeah, 24-hour day people, mm-hmm. and I'm not.
And I don't think Christian astrophysicists are either. And so, you know, we look at Einstein's work, and you're looking at, what, 12 to 14 billion, I don't know, you know, a billion here, a billion there, but that's the age of the universe. And so you have to somehow reconcile it biblically. And so we come back to the beginning, literally, the Genesis question of the, you know, the length of the day, creation day.
Well, and you know what I do, Dan, in that situation, because I get a chance to speak at churches and at groups all over the country, and I,
right.
I know that others do too. And for me, I never typically make a big, I think the most important piece of evidence here that points to the existence of a beginner is the evidence for a beginning, period.
Right.
And how long that it occurred in the past is something that we can now put in a separate box, and we can argue about that all day long. But what we can agree on is the power of Big Bang cosmology. And I think for a lot of Christians who hear that expression, and we're going to run out of time here before we can say much more on this. Sorry, Dan. But I think for most people, they'll hear Big Bang, and they'll think, well, if you buy into Big Bang cosmology, you must also buy into evolutionary theory. Of course, we don't. But
no.
But I think we've got to separate out what the power of Big Bang cosmology and keep it in the place where it actually is, which is it simply provides us with good evidence that there's a beginning into the universe, and that beginning then dictates for the necessity of a beginner. Now, of course, I think most of the future argument is going to be about whether that beginner is natural or supernatural. We can get into that, of course, in the future. But, Dan, thanks so much for calling us here as we wrap up our first hour. Thanks so much. Well, that's it for hour number one as we put that in the box, and we're ready to go on to hour number two. Get ready to call me at 1-800-227-5278. I want to talk to you a little bit about evolution at the start of the next hour. So we'll be back here in about 5 minutes at Stand to Reason. Jim Wallace, Jay Warner Wallace, sitting in for Greg Kokel. Continuing for the Christian Worldview here at Stand to Reason. Glad to be here. Greg's out for another week. Coming back very soon. And Melinda's even gone this week. It's Barbara at the helm. And I think, poor Barbara, she's outnumbered. The inmates are in charge of the facility, I think. It's Aaron. It's true. Aaron Kunkel and I are here. We can almost do anything we want, huh? We should, like, tell... If we don't have clean jokes, we could tell clean jokes for the next 2 hours. We probably could. I could probably Google it, and we could
this
just tell jokes.
This is the show your pastor warned you about.
Yeah, that's probably why, because we are in charge this week. But we're having a good time talking to all of you about the issues that matter most in life, and looking forward to your phone calls here, 1-800-227-5278. Call me, and let's get on the queue, and let's talk about some things that are concerning you about the Christian worldview. As you know, we're here every Sunday from 2 to 5 p.m., and 3 to 5 p.m., this block we're in right now, we're on the American Family Radio Network, so we're being heard all over the country. So wherever you are, this is a chance to call in live, or if you're – that's right, and if you're listening to us streaming online, you can call in right now at 1-800-227-5278. We'll talk about the issues that are popping up in our culture right now that are causing all of us to think carefully about what we believe and why we believe it. And boy, I tell you, there's a lot going on. And I'd love to just read the polls. And I'm one of those guys who's like a blog addict. I mean, I read hundreds of blogs each week, just looking at what others are saying about the Christian worldview, what other apologists are saying in defense of the Christian worldview, what news media sources are reporting. And a couple of things I noticed this week, one on June 6th, was an article that came out, I first saw it at CNSnews.com, that only 15% of Americans believe in godless evolution, according to a new Gallup poll. So I'm going to read it off the website here for you, and I'll try to tweet this or put this on our the Twitter account for STR Talk. By the way, if you want to follow what we're doing on STR Talk or make comments, I will try as also to update that and to listen to what you have to say there and post materials there as well in the hashtag STR Talk on Twitter. Okay, so let's get back to this article that only 15% of Americans believe in a godless evolution, according to Gallup. The article is written by Terrence Jeffrey, posted June 6, 2012. And he says, only 15% of Americans say they believe that the human species evolved from a lower form of life and that God had no part in the process, according to a Gallup poll released on Wednesday. A combined 78% of Americans believe that whether man developed over millions of years or was created from the start in his present form, it was God who did the forming. The survey conducted May 3rd through 6th, Gallup asked 1,024 American adults, which of the following statements comes closest to your views on the origin and development of human beings? One, human beings have developed over millions of years from less advanced forms of life, but God guided the process. Or two, human beings have developed over millions of years from less advanced forms of life, but God had no part in this process. Or three, God created human beings pretty much in their present form at one time within the last 10,000 years or so. And 46% said they believe that God created human beings pretty much in their present form within approximately the last 10,000 years. 32% said human beings developed over millions of years from less advanced forms of life, but God guided the process. And 15% said they believe that man developed over millions of years from less advanced forms of life, but God had no part in it. People with this last view, according to this article, that man evolved from lesser beings without the guiding hand of God, are most likely to be found among people who seldom or never go to church and people who attended postgraduate school. Let's just take a break from the article for a second there. Wow, that's a shock, isn't it, folks, that people who don't go to church don't accept the teachings of church or of the Christian worldview. That shouldn't surprise us. But what is interesting is that this group, the largest or more likely, if you're in this group of 15%, who believe that man developed over millions of years from less advanced forms of life, but God had no part in it, more likely to attend postgraduate school. Now, that's interesting. I've got two postgraduate degrees, and most of us who are here at Stand to Reason have also done postgraduate work. But, of course, it's interesting that the power that the academy has on those of us who maybe at one time even held a theistic view of the world is very much under attack and is very much challenged by the academy, by what happens in the university setting. The fact that the percentage of university professors is largely far more atheistic than the general population is a well-known truth. And that's why I said in the last hour, I talked a little bit about my weekend at Smart Faith Conference. And I love going to these conferences. You get a chance to sit with the thinkers who have kind of examining the issues themselves. And one of those was Frank Turek. And we sat and talked for some time outside the conference and also his talk in the conference, just talking about what we're seeing. And Brett does another great job of this, Brett Kunkel here at Stand to Reason, talking about what is waiting for your kids when they get to the university. And, of course, there is, in the part of many academic professionals, a desire to change the statistics in our country related to how much we would reject or accept the possibility of God's existence and God's intervention in the course of the history of the universe and the history of life on this planet. So let me go back into this article a little bit. And talk about beyond this idea that people who believe take this view that God has no part in this in the process are more likely to be found among people who seldom or never go to church and people who attended postgraduate school. He continues to write here, only 14% of American college graduates believe in godless evolution, the Gallup poll revealed. However, 29% of those who attended graduate school believe man evolved without any involvement by God. Only 3% of Americans who attend church weekly believe in godless evolution. And only 10% of those who attend church almost weekly or monthly. However, among those who seldom or never go to church, 26% believe man evolved without any involvement by God. That, to me, is unremarkable. It really is. What's more interesting to me is the effect that the Academy has. Of course, if you hold this view, you're not likely to step into a church and surround yourself with people who hold a different view, are you? So it doesn't surprise me that people who don't believe God is involved would step out of the church or not step into the church. But I think there is something for us to learn here. Let me step out of this article again for a minute. I think for those of us who are church leaders, and I've been in that position, I think it's important for us to understand that this discussion about how life began, this discussion about how much God is involved in the process, is occurring in the world around us, in a world outside the church. Why are we not talking about it more directly inside the church? It's not that I'm calling for more apologetics in the church. I certainly am. But I'm at least calling for church leaders to recognize what it is that faces young people once they step out those doors, and really what it is that faces all of us. Because as we lose our certainty in the things of God, our certainty in God's existence or God's involvement in our world, if you're a young person, you're far more likely to just walk away from your faith altogether. But if you're an older person like me, you're far more likely to sit on your hands. To develop a faith that maybe guides my behavior, but really runs from the challenges, and is far less likely to share what I believe is true with those around me who might make fun of me. Well, I think it's important for us to embrace a view of apologetics in the church that both, one, helps young people to hold on to the truth, but two, equips older folks to be more vocal about what it is they believe. I think a lack of certainty, number one, allows young people to leave, but it also encourages older folks like me to stay quiet, to stay silent, to not want to get in the conversation. Anyway, the article continues that among Americans who attend church every week, 67% believe that God created man pretty much in his present form within approximately the last 10,000 years. 55% of Americans who attend church almost every week or monthly share this view. Democrats and independents, according to Gallup, are more likely to believe in a godless evolution, 19% of each group do, than Republicans, only 5% do. That's an interesting fact, and although I'm, for the most part, apolitical on some issues like this, I think we can look at where people stand in terms of what they would embrace race for social behavior, and there is a connection, isn't there? It's probably not a coincidence that most of us who consider ourselves to be conservative, not meaning politically conservative, I mean socially conservative, the idea that I believe there are some principles about social behavior that we ought to conserve from the past because they are valuable, transcendent truths that we ought to embrace to ensure a good future. That's what I mean when I say I'm conservative. But of course, a lot of what I believe about what we ought to embrace is affirmed by my biblical worldview. And I'd have to walk away from my biblical worldview in order to embrace a more open-minded view, let's say, of sexual behavior that embraces all kinds of other things. And I think when people do that, they naturally walk away from the church. So anyway, the idea here is interesting for all of us to discuss. Gallup has been asking, according to this article, Gallup has been asking Americans this question about God and evolution since 1982. And in its analysis of the current survey, the polling firm said that Americans have been very consistent in believing God had a hand in man's development. Quote, despite the many changes that have taken place in American society and culture over the past 30 years, including new discoveries in biological and social science, there has been virtually no sustained change in Americans' views of the origin of the human species since 1982, said Gallup's analysis. In 1982, according to the historical data published by Gallup, 44% said that God created man as is within the past 10,000 years, 38% said that man evolved with God's guiding hand, and 9% said man evolved and God had no part in the process. That's very interesting to me, because it appears that the numbers on this, about what we believe, about how we appeared on the planet, our views really haven't changed, have they? And so I think we have to kind of look, and part of this may be because we are becoming more and more familiar with the definition of evolution and what it means, and that's why I want to take a second to talk about how it is that we define evolution and what we really mean by the definition. One of the best and clearest and briefest thinking on this was, I thought, was written by Jay Richards. It's in an old most recently published in the Christian Research Journal in Volume 35, Number 1 in 2012 here. And Jay Richards is talking about the topic of evolution and is the different definitions that are given to it. And the article is entitled Thinking Clearly About God and Evolution. And what Richards writes here is, I think, pretty powerful. And he writes this: it's a lot easier to define theism than to define evolution. That's an important point. Let's step out for a second. That is a very important point. Most of us assume we are talking about the same thing when we toss around the word evolution. And we have to be careful when we have this discussion with non-believers and with other fellow believers that we are clear about what it is we mean. Because there's a knee-jerk reaction to words like Big Bang, to words like evolution inside the church, because we aren't careful about defining what it is we mean when we say evolution. So let's get back to Jay Richards' article where he writes, it's a lot easier to define theism than to define evolution. It's been called the ultimate weasel word. In an illuminating article called The Meanings of Evolution, Stephen Meyer and Michael Kays attempt to catch the weasel by distinguishing six different ways in which evolution is commonly used. And I think that this distinction of these six different ways evolution, the word evolution is used, will be helpful for us as we talk to our friends. Number one, he says, change over time. The history of nature, any sequence of events in nature. So there's the first definition. Let's go on back into the article. Number two, he says, changes in the frequency of alleles in the gene pool of a population. Okay. The third definition he offers, limited common descent, the idea that particular groups of organisms have descended from a common ancestor. Okay. Number four, the mechanisms responsible for the change required to produce limited descent with modification, chiefly natural selection acting on random variations or mutations. Those are the first four definitions. Now, we're going to come back to those because I think that those are very important, because I think that those first four are clearly four that you and I would embrace if we thought clearly about them. They say nothing that would oppose our Christian worldview. But let's go on to the last two. Number five, universal common descent, the idea that all organisms have descended from a single common ancestor. And then finally here in the article, number six offered, blind watchmaker thesis, the idea that all organisms have descended from common ancestors solely through unguided, unintelligent, purposeless, material processes, such as the natural selection acting on random variations or mutations, that the mechanisms of natural selection, random variation and mutation, and perhaps other similarly naturalistic mechanisms are completely sufficient to account for the appearance of design in living organisms. Here's what he writes here. As Christians, what are we to make of these six different definitions of evolution? Now, let me tell you where I'm also getting some of this from. It's a great blog. If you aren't listening, reading it, Bill Pratt is an author at toughquestionsanswered.org. It's one of the number of blogs that I read. And he did a great service, I think, for us in listing out what Jay Richards writes here, the six different definitions of evolution. And you can find this in How is Evolution Defined, Part 1. It's over at toughquestionsanswered.org. Just Google it through there. You'll find Bill Pratt's excellent article on this. Here's what Bill writes. As Christians, what are we to make of these six different definitions of evolution? Definitions 1 through 4 are almost universally accepted by young Earth, old Earth, and theistic evolutionists. They all agree that plant and animal populations have changed over time, and that there's limited common descent, and that natural selection acting on a random mutation does affect plant and animal populations. Now, many of you listening to this, let me step out of the article for a minute, might go, wait a minute, I don't believe in that. I'm a Christian, I don't accept any of that. Actually, if you think it through, you probably do. We would argue, for example, that the entire species of humans on the planet, all of us in all of our variety, our racial variety, the variety of appearances, shapes and sizes, all of us come from one set of parents, don't we? And if nothing else, at the flood, we all funnel back down through the three sons of Noah. So we would argue that all of us are different from each other based on small modifications that are limited within the species, that are responding to variations in our environment, variations in our situation, that actually produce limited variations limited modifications that are within the species. So if you hold a Christian worldview, I think that these first four ideas related to evolution are quite easy for us to embrace. But look what Bill Pratt says as he continues. Definition number five is where young earth and old earth creationists get off the boat. These folks believe that God especially created different kinds of plants and animals at specific moments in earth's history. Old earth creationists stretch out those creative acts over some 3.5 to 4 billion years, whereas young earth creationists compact those creative acts into a 6-day period. In either case, it would be impossible for universal common descent to be true. Finally, theistic evolutionists would have no problem. Evolutionists, rather, would have no problem with definition five. That's true. And then he says about definition six. Definition six is where even theistic evolutionists disembark. Why? Because they do not accept that evolution is unguided, unintelligent, and purposeless. God is behind evolution, according to these theistic evolutionists, and he planned it out and executed on the plan through the initial conditions and physical laws that he put in place. So I think this is a great opportunity for us to look at the different definitions of evolution and understand that there are some aspects of evolution that you and I as Christians can embrace. And there are, of course, some aspects of the evolution theory as it's taught today that we would have to reject. The question we would have to say is this process completely unguided and random? Because if it is, there's no need for a guider. But if, on the other hand, it appears there's some guidance is necessary, we'd have to ask, what is it that is guiding the process, speeding it up, turning it in certain directions, providing new information, providing any information at all? What is causing this? And that's where you and I say we believe that in this process, however we think about how we first got here, we would say the evidence seems to suggest there is some need for some guidance at some point in the process. And if that is the case, the most reasonable inference from that evidence is that we have a guider in place. So we can talk more about that if you want to as we delve into that issue and other issues related to ethics, value, and religion right here at Stand to Reason. We'll take a break and come right back. Give me a call at 1-800-227-5278.
Did God really say? It's the oldest temptation in human history, one that targets the authority of God's Word at its very foundation. Its modern rephrasing takes many forms, both in academia and in popular culture. Are the New Testament documents reliable? Have ancient biblical books been lost or suppressed by the early church? Are the words of the Bible just flawed human inventions? These questions introduce doubt at the point of contact between God and man, undermining the Christian's confidence in the words of Scripture. Even those secure in their affirmation of divine authorship must wrestle with similar questions. Did God really say to me? In other words, do the promises of Scripture apply to the individual Christian's life today or only to those originally addressed? How is one to understand and apply these biblical assurances? In this timely collection of essays called Ancient Words, Reflections on the Reliability and Proper Use of Scripture, Greg carefully addresses each of these issues, providing both solid evidence for the reliability of Scripture and a clear roadmap for how it should be read and applied. Greg's responses to these popular challenges to biblical authority will help reinforce your confidence in this trustworthy book. Go to Stand to Reason's online store at www.str.org and get a copy of Ancient Words or call 1-800-2-REASON.
Is there ever a right time to judge? What did Jesus mean when he said, "Do not judge so that you will not be judged"? I'm Brett Kunkel, and you can hear the answer to this question on my Bulletproof podcast this month. Download Bulletproof from iTunes or the podcast page at str.org.
Did you know that nearly a billion cell phones were sold last year? And every year, 500 million obsolete cell phones gather dust in desk drawers or end up in landfills. I want to tell you how you can transform your unused cell phone and even your used car from a natural hazard into ministry impact to equip Christian ambassadors by donating them to Stand to Reason. Old cars and cell phones can be turned into radio time, podcasts, and other training resources that can build a whole new generation of ambassadors for Jesus Christ. Think of it. Because of your donation, Christians just like you will be able to effectively share their faith and change the lives of others forever. Now, to donate your old car or cell phone, just call iDonate at 877-897-4273 or visit iDonate.com and search for Stand to Reason. They'll take care of everything for you and STR. Not only can you donate old cars and cell phones, but iDonate can help you with all kinds of non-cash donations for STR. Just call them at 877-897-4273 or visit iDonate.com. And thanks so much for making Stand to Reason's work possible.
Today, Jay Warren Wallace sitting in for Greg Kokel here at Stand to Reason. Another beautiful afternoon in sunny Southern California, but it was not, it's not as sunny here as it was over the weekend in Phoenix, Arizona at the Smart Faith Conference. It was there with Brett and a bunch of other great speakers, one of which was Frank Turk. And I want to bring up the point that we talk a lot here, and we've been talking in the last few weeks about the Cross-Examined Instructor Academy. Let me just give you some information about that, because so many times those of you who listen to this show want to know how you can turn your – and this question even came up at the conference. How can I turn my interest in apologetics into something powerful in my local church? How can I turn it into something powerful in my community? How can I take this avocational interest I have, maybe even someday turn it into a vocational passion? And a lot of the ways we talk about blooming in where you're planted, we talk about serving right where you are in whatever context you're in, but sometimes you need a little extra training to become equipped to do what it is God is having you do, where it is you feel that you are God has called you to do, that you're shaped to do. And what's very interesting in this is we look for avenues in which to kind of prepare ourselves, right? Gosh, should I go back to grad school? Can I really afford to go back to grad school to learn more about this? Maybe I don't even have an undergraduate degree. How am I going to get trained to do this and do it well? Well, that's where organizations like crossexamine.org can come in and actually fill a void, fill a need. And the CIA Academy is offered every summer. This summer it's been offered from August 9th to 11th. And I've talked about it here on the show the last couple of weeks. But when you hang out with Frank, you get a sense that he's just a lot of fun to be with. So it's not just going to be all about information, and it'll be a push. It'll be a test. You will go there and be stretched. There's a process by which you have to apply to this, and once you get there, you will. I meet a lot of people who have been to the CIA Academy, and they get there and they are challenged. And sometimes it's an eye opener. What you need to improve, what you could do better, how do you present the materials? You're actually going to get a chance to present in front of people who present for a living, and they're going to get a chance to give you feedback on how you're doing. But after it's over, you will be equipped to do something powerful in your community. And a good example of that is Sean White, who actually ran this conference last weekend. He's done two of these Smart Faith conferences. And this conference yesterday was three times larger than the conference he ran last year. And that's the kind of growth he's seeing through efforts. And sure enough, Sean White is a graduate of the CIA Academy. The Instructors Academy. So I want to get you to get online if you are interested in this at crossexamined.org. You'll see a link there on the sidebar for the Instructor Academy. Go there. You'll see what's required. You'll see what the dates are, how to get in contact with Frank to get on that list. And you'll see the instructors, some great instructors, including both Greg and Brett, who will be there teaching with Frank at this academy. So get online. I want to encourage you to do that. It's a great way to prepare yourself. And like Sean White, have a chance to really transform both your church and your community by becoming a really pretty good apologist in his own right. And then he's engaging other apologists to come in and help reach his community. So a great opportunity awaits you if you get over to the Cross-Examined Academy. All right. Having said that, let's go to Greg in New York. Hi, Greg. How are you doing, sir?
Hey, how are you? I'm doing well.
Good.
I enjoy calling into the program once in a while. The thing is, the format is really hard sometimes to ask questions. So I actually wanted to ask, is there a way I can actually get in touch with the Academy? I'm sort of curious, more from the point of view of trying to find the truth. And so I would actually pose my questions to people trying to witness for Christ and the apologetics. I think it would be very helpful for me to sort of figure out answers, not within the scope of a couple minutes, but on a more general scale. Is there a way I can get in touch with the Academy?
Well, if it's not the Academy at crossexamine.org, I mean, I'm sure that actually Frank's got a way to reach him through his own website. But I know that both STR and Please Convince Me, we have kind of open formats in which people can pose questions and get feedback from all kinds of people. And for us, for example, at Please Convince Me, we have a Facebook fan page. It's very easy to get a, be a part of it. You click the button to join it. I, of course, will let you in right away. And you'll be able to post your questions. I know STR also has got a page online on Facebook. Stand to Reason has a page. And so that's probably a good way to engage in dialogue, not just with the apologists like us who frequent the sites, but also with other believers and non-believers who are engaged in that dialogue. And so for us, at least, at Please Convince Me, the best way is to go on the Facebook fan page. But I know also Stand to Reason has a very similar process there as well. And I think also you'll notice if you follow the STR blog, you'll see that constantly there are posts being made that I'll bet you, Greg, that you might have a question about any of the number of those things that are being discussed. And there's a place there where you can actually dialogue underneath in the posts to kind of ask questions back and forth. So I think those are a couple of places, ways you can engage in that process of dialogue. And you're right. It's not easy to ask the kind of question you want to ask or to kind of get the kind of because you may be asking a question that would be something you could spend hours talking about, and of course in a radio show you're only going to get minutes to do it. So I understand the dilemma. But today you did have a question about how what was your question about Jewish people and how they would go to heaven? Is that your question?
Well, sure. So one of the things that kind of bothers me about Christianity, and let me just give you the background. You know, I grew up in a Jewish family, but I'm certainly open to, and I studied a lot about Christianity and in general. I think I know about it, the theology. But the thing that really bothered me about it, and I haven't gotten a really good Christian answer for this, is according at least to the Protestant Christianity, you know, if you don't believe in Jesus the right way, you essentially go to hell. And there's certain ways to sugarcoat this and say, well, you don't really go to hell, you can't be with God, because God wouldn't allow you in his presence and so forth. But then, at the end of the day, this person who might not have ever heard about Jesus, has literally no chance of getting into this place, with God. And so that bothers me a little bit on the level that people were created with pretty much zero chance, and so they're doomed to go to hell. But my question is this. It seems to me that in the Old Testament, the Jewish people, there's a lot of them that God loves, and they certainly never heard about Jesus. And so, you know, when it says in Acts that there's no other name under heaven whereby we must be saved and so forth, I look at that as maybe hyperbole or something. But if we take it literally, really what I would like to ask is, Jewish people that God made a covenant with, imagine a Jew at the time of, let's say, Paul.
Yes.
Why would he suddenly trust the word, because Jesus had already been crucified, let's say, and he never met Jesus. So now Paul or one of his disciples comes to him, like a former fisherman or Pharisee. He comes and he said, listen, I know that God spoke to your ancestors and said that you should always follow the law and it's forever. I know that he said that you shouldn't worship idols, but trust me, it's okay. This is not an idol. I saw him personally. He was resurrected. Trust me, it's God's son. You can eat pork now. It's fine. I just don't see why the Jew, who his whole life was taught that this is the most major thing, not the pork, but abandoning God's law and following some other religion. Why would this Jew suddenly trust a follower of Christ, especially today? And so that's kind of my question. How can the Jews be punished for doubting somebody who
sure.
You just have to take their word for it.
Okay, listen, you've asked a lot of good questions, but you have, I think you'll have to admit, Greg, asked a lot of questions. So there's a lot of different ways to go on this approach. I'm going to try my best to kind of rein in what the big issues are at stake. Let me just start off with where I come from as well. I was not raised as a Christian. I became a Christian at 35. So I'm also I've always got one foot in my past skepticism, and I've got one foot in the truth of what I believe is the best inference from the evidence. So I look at this philosophically as well as evidentially. It seems
sure.
to me.
By the way, I'm sorry. I don't want to interrupt. I just because you'll have plenty of time to answer it. I just want to say one little thing. The Jews have the added factor. It's sort of like Russian roulette. It's like if the disciples made things up and they shouldn't really follow, then God will punish them for switching religions, and as he had, you know, with all the conquests and Babylonians and so forth. How did the Jews know that this time it was really God? Why didn't he
okay.
speak to all the Jewish people?
Well, let me answer. I'm going to try my best to answer some of those questions for you. I'll take a few few minutes, sure, but just give me a little kind of rope here to kind of run out and try to get a couple of these answers under our belt here. I think part of it is that, no problem. I think part of it is, and I would be happy to have you call back again, and I'll be sitting in for Greg, and Greg will be back. I know I've heard him talk to you in the past about some of these issues, so I know this, we're never afraid to continue this dialogue, so don't worry about that, Greg. But as we kind of go through this, I look at this. If the evidence for the beginning of the universe is what I think it is, the best evidence we have, that this universe came into existence from nothing, that whatever it is that began this process, and even if you are a Jewish believer, you would, I think, accept the idea that this God we're talking about is absolutely tremendously powerful. So powerful, sure, he is described as all powerful. So powerful that we would, I think, reasonable to believe that he has the power to eliminate imperfection. We're talking about a God who is perfect by his very, very nature. And I think that this kind of God who has the power to eliminate imperfection is, he would be in a realm, his standard would be not goodness, but it would be perfection, because he has the power to eliminate imperfection. So right away, hang on, let me just finish for a second. As I look at that, I think to myself, well, of all the different theistic worldviews that have to deal with my human imperfection, I don't think that a God like this is all that impressed with my good works. By the nature of who this God is, by his very nature, I suspect that he's not all that impressed even with my strongest effort. In the end, in order to be united with this God, I need to be in a place of perfection. I need to be positionally perfect, not positionally good. There has to be some way for me to eliminate, to pay for those sins, to address those sins in my life. Even as a Jew, you would see this in the Old Testament. Now, we can kind of look at, and so I'm looking for a system that is not predicated or not built on the good work efforts of its believers, because I don't think any of us could ever be good enough for a perfect God. I'm looking for some system that creates positional perfection for me so I can be reunited to a God who I could never earn perfection with because my works are never good enough. And that really eliminates a lot of...
You're talking about an eternal afterlife.
I'm talking about the afterlife,
right?
Yes. So I think that for me that eliminates a lot of theistic worldviews. But even if I didn't have that at all, you've brought up two very good points. Number one, what do we make of those Old Testament believers, those saints of the Old Testament, the ones that are described in Hebrews as the heroes of the faith,
right,
who did not know of Jesus? Did they know anything about Jesus? How are they saved? That's one good question to ask. I think that's a fair question for you to ask. The second question I think I hear in your voice, as in your tone and in your questions as you bring them to me, is that how is it that we know, why should they be certain, in fact, that what these apostles were talking about in the book of Acts was even reliable? I mean, why should I drop everything that the God who I've been following my entire life, why should I believe now that these a whole new set of principles are in place just because these silly apostles have said so?
Exactly. Those are really, especially when God said it would be eternal, the law would be eternal.
Well, those are really two separate questions, and I'll point you to a resource I've written online for one of those questions, because I want to be respectful of everyone's time here, but I do want to focus on the second question if I can. I think that it's absolutely – I'm with you. I had a similar question. It wasn't, you know, why should I as a Jew abandon what I believe God has told me for this Christian system that you now say is in place? Why should I do that? I had the same kind of question. Why should I, as an atheist, abandon what I believe in order to embrace what you say is true as a Christian? So I had a very similar question.
God will not punish you.
Well, I didn't believe there was a God to punish me. I believe I died, you're in the dirt, and I was very happy with that. I mean, I'm still pretty happy with that.
God punishing you.
What's that?
Sorry. Your starting position doesn't involve God punishing you in case you are.
Well, as you probably. Yeah, but as you probably know, Greg, there's lots of Christian annihilationists who believe that God's punishment is simply annihilation, that in the end they end up annihilated. And I, as an atheist, also took that position as an atheist. In the end, I end up in the dirt with no consciousness. There was no life beyond this one. So, I mean, I think that there are some similarities in there. So I'm just saying that as an atheist, I took a very similar approach. I had to decide if what these gospel writers were saying was true. I had to decide if these gospel writers were simply that, writers, or if in fact they were eyewitnesses. And were they reliable eyewitnesses? I think that people in the first century who were Jewish, who were listening to the apostles, had to make a decision about whether or not what the apostles were saying was evidentially true. And what were they saying? The question I had is, what was it that the apostles were preaching about? How were they evangelizing in the book of Acts in the first century? What were they doing? You know, we have lots of, as Christians, you see a lot of different systems we put in place to share the gospel. You know,
they were speaking in tongues. They were,
yes. So should it be a matter of speaking? But if you look at it carefully, Greg, you're going to find that over and over again, the apostles took the same approach in evangelism. The same approach over and over and over again. Number one, they identified themselves as eyewitnesses of something. Number two, sure, they testified to the resurrection. Over and over and over again, the system upon which the apostles evangelized the first century was by testifying as eyewitnesses to the resurrection, because they knew what the resurrection meant. If the resurrection really occurred, if the resurrection is true, everything else flows out of that. This is why,
yes,
Paul, it's a big if. It's a huge if. Are you kidding?
Well, hold on 1 second. I'll even challenge that one, though. Why is it that if a man is resurrected, we don't know who resurrected him. In the Old Testament, there were resurrections as well. Why does the resurrection prove that now God changed the rules?
Hold on a second. I've only got about a minute before the break, so I want to squeeze in an answer here if I can for you, Greg. The very people who were testifying about a resurrection were not just testifying about a resurrection. They're testifying about the resurrection of the man who they knew for all the years before he was crucified, who knew what this man taught, and after the resurrection continued to teach. So the reliability of who Jesus is tied directly to the truth of the resurrection. The power of what Jesus spoke is tied to the truth of the resurrection. For me, as a non-believer who was examining the evidence, I needed to know, what are the minimal facts? What are the facts about the resurrection? What are the possible explanations? What can I best infer in terms of explanations from those facts? That was the quest that I was on as a non-believer, because that's the same quest I'm on every time I work any cold case. What are the facts in the room? What are the possible explanations for those facts? And then what's the best inference from the evidence in terms of possible explanations? Which of these possible explanations is the one most reasonable explanation? And for me, that's how I started the adventure. Now, I can tell you that this is an adventure that all of us, this is a quest all of us should be on. And the reason I think why as many people came to Christ in the first century was because they trusted, for whatever reason, I trust it evidentially, that what the apostles said was an accurate and reliable eyewitness testimony about the resurrection. Now, I realize that many people would say, I could never get to that level of certainty based on a historical event, and you may feel that way yourself, Greg. But I can tell you that we owe it to ourselves to at least begin that type of evidential process. And I'm afraid we're going to be now begin with
a
hard break. Yeah, I'm so sorry. But
yeah.
Listen, get online both at Stand to Reason
please
convince me. You know what? I'm going to let you go, Greg, and please call back next week, and we'll talk again. Okay. Thanks so much, Greg. I appreciate your patience with me.
Okay.
Well, then we are up against a hard break right now. We'll take a quick 2-minute break. Come back right here on Stand to Reason.
We are ambassadors for Christ. That's what Paul tells us in 2 Corinthians 5:20. An effective ambassador has three essential skills. First, an ambassador must have the basic knowledge necessary for his task. Second, this knowledge must be deployed in a skillful way. There's an element of wisdom, a tactical and artful diplomacy that makes his message persuasive. Third is character. His personal maturity and individual virtue will either make or break his message. Stand to Reason's mission is to help you develop the foundational skills in each one of these areas. In Essential Ambassador Skills, Greg Kokel will train you in all three of these areas to be an effective ambassador for Christ and to represent God's message of grace in a broken world. To order this unique message, call 1-800-2-REASON or go to our website, str.org. 800-2-REASON or str.org to order Essential Ambassador Skills by Greg Kokel.
Do you want to know the one question I ask same-sex marriage advocates when they claim that homosexuals don't have equal protection under the law? To find out what it is, download my podcast, Thinking Out Loud, from iTunes or the podcast page at str.org.
In the United States, over 51 million abortions have been performed since it was legalized in 1973. That's one abortion every 26 seconds. If you have been wanting to be able to speak out effectively against abortion, or just be better prepared to discuss this often heated and always emotional topic, STR has a great resource to help equip you to do that. Stand to Reason Interactive, Making Abortion Unthinkable, prepares you for any pro-life encounter, from one-on-one discussions to a public debate, with the confidence that your case is solid, your knowledge deep, and your argument just. Created to be used as a personal study or in a small group setting in your church or home, this easy-to-follow, well-reasoned, plug-and-play course provides the basic training for anyone to become proficient in the art of pro-life persuasion. Through video, workbooks, role-playing, and quizzes, Making Abortion Unthinkable will prepare you to restore meaning to the word abortion using compelling visual aids, simplify the abortion issue by focusing on one strategic question, present scientific evidence to offer a sound, reasonable, and persuasive argument, expose the four common flaws of pro-abortion rhetoric, clear the red herring objections, and stay on course. Be respectful toward the person you're talking with. If you haven't yet taken a stand against abortion, call Stand to Reason today at 1-800-2-REASON. That's 1-800-2-REASON. Or visit us on the web at str.org.
We are back again.
Stand to Reason.
We're talking about all kinds of interesting issues, including, you know, I'm just posting right now as I'm talking to you. I'm trying to multitask. I don't know if I can do this. I noticed there's a reason probably why Greg does not try to do this, because it makes you sound silly on the radio. But I'm trying to multitask, and there we go. I just wanted to tweet out a couple of resources related to the issue on the last call about how is it that people were saved before Jesus. That's something that I have written a little bit about, only because I was asked to do so by Sean McDowell when we wrote the Student Apologetics Bible, which I've also got featured on our homepage at Please Convince Me. And so it's lots of issues that all of us have questions about. We're challenged on these issues. So we write small 500-word responses. We're trying to keep those briefs to help you in that Bible, to help you move through these issues. So if you've got a young person who is getting ready to go to college or is in high school and maybe is part of a youth group, I would suggest that you take the time to go get that. It's a great resource to kind of help them navigate these issues. Let's go to Jeff in Des Moines, Iowa. Jeff, how are you? Let's see. I think I have him now. Jeff, is that you?
Yeah.
Hey, sorry. I'm always afraid I'm going to push the wrong button, and most of the time I actually do push the wrong button, so I got you now. Jeff in Des Moines, Iowa. How are you, sir?
I'm doing good. Hey, I had a quick question for you, and I kind of struggled to put it into words, so I'll do the best that I can.
No problem.
Basically, it has to do with same-sex marriage and the dialogue between traditionalists and gay activists on the topic of equal rights.
Okay.
And I know a claim is typically made by homosexual activists that they want equal rights to marry. And in my studies on the topic, I've come across several responses to that. And one that I agree with is that they do have equal rights. What they're asking for is additional rights. And this is where my question comes in. I'm kind of anticipating a possible response they might have.
Okay.
And that might be like, you're missing the point. Homosexuals deserve the right to marry according to their sexual orientation, just like heterosexuals. And so I was curious if you had thoughts on that.
Yeah, I do. I think that what you read, where did you find that resource that you're kind of quoting there on the idea of additional rights?
That is from actually several different ones. One's okay. From Frank Turek, one is from Stanton and Meyer, mm-hmm. Marriage on Trial. It's
okay.
In that book, too.
Yeah, very good. Those are some good resources. I kind of agree with this too, only because I've kind of learned, and you've got two sets of people you have to make the case with, right? You make the case with those who are inside our worldview and those who are outside our worldview. So believe it or not, we have to make this case even with those who are in the church. I wish it wasn't so. But there's lots of things we have to make a case for with our brothers and sisters in Christ. So it's not a big deal. I think we need to be prepared, though. There are two different strategies I would use. What you're talking about now is making a case with people who are outside our worldview, for the most part, I would imagine. But I suppose there could be people inside the church who believe that they can still have this discussion and still call themselves Christians. So I think we have to make the case in one of two ways. I think when you talk about the additional rights, I'm inclined in that direction, and here's how I would pose it. I think all of this, and I've tried to be simple about this and single-minded, like I was with the caller earlier today, I think it all comes down to the role that government plays. And it only does one of three things. It prohibits, permits, or promotes. So sometimes when you hear someone say, we should have the right to be married, you have to really kind of mine that out. If what you mean is you should have the right to be in a committed relationship with each other, even in a relationship that you might see as somehow recognized and has certain equal rights within the law related to how property is disposed after a death, how what medical rights are available between mates. I mean, lots of states have taken different approaches on how to approach that one issue. But if what you mean is that you should be allowed to, you should be permitted to have the right to have that kind of relationship, you and I would agree with that. Mm-hmm. The question is not whether you have the right. The question is whether or not we should promote this particular form of union. We're not saying you don't have the right to have a relationship, but we're saying that this title of marriage, at the very least, at the very minimal, and of course we say it's much more as Christians, but at the very minimal, this idea of marriage is a way that government promotes a certain form of family unit for the benefit of offspring. It's designed to do that one thing. So we would say, of course, we all have the same rights to be engaged in a long-term committed relationship that has the benefit of certain laws and protections under the law. And that is the case right now in states that are still arguing for same-sex marriage. They already have civil unions and other laws in place that provide them with those rights. What they want is not the permission to be engaged with each other in a long-term committed relationship. What they want is to be promoted in a way that's similar to the promotion of other forms of family. To say there's really no difference, even in the raising of a child, between raising that child in a family unit which is low conflict with two biological parents, that is exactly the same as raising a child in any other form of family. They're all the same. Whether it's a single parent, whether it is adopted parents, whether it is same-sex parents. But clearly, we see that statistics tell us that, forget about sexuality, we know that children do best when raised in families with two biological parents that are in a low-conflict relationship. And we want to advance and promote that because it's in the best interest of children. It's not about a right. We're not going to take away their right. We're not trying to set up laws to prohibit same-sex relationships or committed same-sex relationships. We're not trying to establish laws that would destroy any legal protection of those types of unions. We're simply saying we want to preserve the promotion of this ideal for the benefit of children. So to me, it's I'm stepping off the idea of what's – they have a right. And what I love about the approach of simply recognizing what government does is that if you think about it, we are in a very good place as believers, as followers of Christ. We agree that to permit some activities. And we are simply saying we want to promote this ideal. And guess what? You know, I'll tell you something. That ideal didn't even apply to me as a Christian. I was raised in a single parent family. It was not the ideal model. I would not suggest that we somehow bless or somehow promote that form of raising children over two biological parents in a low conflict setting. Did I come out okay? Probably. But was it ideal? No. And I now have adopted children. Okay. Is it ideal for them? No, it's not ideal for them. I wouldn't even promote that. So we're not. I would permit it, but I would not promote it as the ideal. There is an ideal I would promote, and that is two biological parents in a low-conflict setting.
Okay. What would you say to – I'm just playing devil's advocate here.
Yeah, of course.
I agree with you that government has a role to promote marriage. I totally agree with that. But the government also has a role to promote liberty and protect liberty. So I totally get the move from liberty to move to children to support the idea that we should not promote this because heterosexual marriage is better for children. But I could foresee someone ignoring that or addressing that and coming back to the point government also has the ability to promote liberty. And we get back onto the topic of orientation.
Well, liberty in and of itself is a dangerous word because it's so undefined. Do I have the liberty to do some things? Okay, it's okay. So if I got two consenting adults who happen to be brother and sister, Do they have the liberty to be married? Do we want to promote? Do we allow that? I mean, the same logic says that there's lots of things that I would say, hey, I want to have the liberty to do this. I've got a how about this? I'm a 60-year-old man, and I've got a very intelligent 13-year-old niece who I think is able to make her own decisions. As a matter of fact, she's been emancipated from her parents for legal reasons. Ought I be able to marry her? I think she can make her own decisions. Okay, she's 15. I mean, where would we draw this line at what is a matter of personal liberty and what is a matter that we would say, well, look, we're trying to make sure that we do the three things the government does well, promote, permit, or prohibit.
And there are some things
I think for me, I think in terms of when government steps in, those are the only things that governments can do. Jeff, I mean, think about it for a second. And I think when we're talking about – let's just say take a little different approach to this then. Let's say that liberty is a good thing. I would agree liberty is a good thing. I would say also protecting the rights of children, the rights that I'm not just recognizing as a Christian, the rights that have been recognized by UNICEF right in 1989. We talked about this a couple weeks ago, that the United Nations recognizes the right of the child as established in the Convention of the Rights of the Child in 1989. They recognize the fact that children have the right to be raised by their two biological parents. You see it in Article 7 of the UNICEF Rights of the Child. So this is the ideal form that they say is a right of children. So here's what it comes down to. If we say liberty is a good thing, we also say this right of children is a good thing. And now we're stuck with a moral dilemma. Yes, it would be good to honor all kinds of liberties. But in this case, it's a far better thing. This is the nature of all moral dilemmas. Trying to decide between two goods is often our obligation as government, our obligation as Christians, our obligation as citizens, deciding between two things, which is the greater thing we want to advance. And here I would have to say that the recognition of rights of kids ought to be seen as that greater thing. So don't let people kind of characterize the debate over marriage as a battle between what we say is good and bad. I'm okay with characterizing it as a battle between good and greater. Okay, right. Certain liberties are good. The rights of children are greater. And if I have to make a choice here, and I don't believe it really is a matter of making a choice here, but even if I conceded that the liberties are so much more important, or so important, I would never concede that they're more important than the rights of children, who are typically voiceless in our society. And that's why we give them such latitude. The rights of children are so respected because we recognize that, for the most part, they are voiceless to defend their own rights.
I totally get that. And as a Christian, I know where I can ground liberty and rights in, and that's God and His mm-hmm. His nature and being made in the image of God. But when talking to non-believers, it's just I don't know what criteria to use to say the rights of the children supersede those of these people. I don't know if that's putting words in your mouth or not, but.
I'm okay with actually characterizing it that way, Jeff. I think that all moral decisions are made. All decisions made by governments are weighing between two goods or two bads, or trying to make decisions about what best advantage we want to give to the thriving of our culture, the thriving of our society. And in this case, I think we recognize, but before anything else, that the rights of the child must be protected. And if the rights of the child to be, if at all possible, of course, to be in the context of a two biological parent family in which there's low conflict, if that is the rights of the child, I want to honor those first. And aside from that, Jeff, I never saw this as a liberty issue. If liberty was the first and foremost, can you imagine? Couldn't anybody who's arrested for anything say, I should have the liberty to do this? I should have the liberty. I mean, why can't I have then a sister and a brother have the liberty to have that kind of marriage? Why can't I have, like I suggested before, if I've got a child who I can demonstrate has a certain rational capacity, why shouldn't I have the liberty to marry children? This is the whole point we're saying is, where do you draw the line with liberty? And we're going to come against a hard break at the end of this hour, Jeff, so I'm so sorry we're not going to be able to do much more with this. But I hope, even as we kind of talk about that a little bit, it'll help you to kind of think through the issues. And please, Jeff, call us back and we'll talk more about it. Is that okay?
Good.
Hey, thanks, Jeff. I appreciate your call so much.
Thank you.
And now we're going to get ready at the end of this hour, second hour here at Stand to Reason. Next hour, I've got a special guest in studio. It is Mark Middleberg, the author of The Reason Why, a new book that I want to talk to you about, and, of course, other great books like The Questions Christians Ask and Choosing Your Faith. Mark will be in the studio with me here, coming up right after the break, right here on Stand to Reason.
would like to ask you a very important question.
Are you talking to me?
Ah, so great to be with you today. G.A. Warner-Wallace sitting in for Greg Kokel on Stand to Reason in hour number three, being heard all across America on American Family Radio Network, as we are every week from 3 to 5 p.m. And, of course, we are actually on the air from 2 to 5 p.m. So if you've missed any part of the show, that's right, be sure to call us or to reach our podcast page at str.org. You'll be able to see the entire archive of all of our shows going back for years. And certainly you can get this week's show, which is all 3 hours. We talked about a number of things related to evolution. And lots of good calls, so be sure to go back and pick up that podcast. But this hour, I'm really privileged to have Mark Middleburg in the studio with me. And he just walked in and sat down. Of course, we're talking about all things we shouldn't even be talking about getting ready for this. We should be talking about what we're going to talk about. But we didn't, Mark. So now I didn't ask you what I can and can't ask you. So I'm about to ask you a bunch of stuff I shouldn't probably even ask you.
You're a detective. I expect that.
Okay, well, that's probably exactly what's going to happen. But anyway, aside from that, let me just introduce Mark first. Mark is, you know, as most people who track along with apologetics and are interested in apologetics enough to listen to this broadcast probably already know who Mark is, because he's a great author, has written a lot of bestsellers, including going back in terms of your apologetics work. I'm looking at, well, everyone probably knows you first from Becoming a Contagious Christian, and most people know you from that to begin with. But then you started doing a lot of good apologetics work, and including this book, which I think you're just updated, Choosing Your Faith in a World of Spiritual Options. I have one of the first books that when it came out, so I have an old copy, which you're going to sign for me today. And of course, he also wrote a book called The Questions Christians Hope No One Will Ask, with answers, and we'll be talking about that a little bit today. And then we just saw each other in Dallas a couple of weeks ago, and I got a copy of The Reason Why, and Faith Makes Sense at the bottom of that. We'll be talking more about that in a bit. A book you just wrote, which is based on an older work that is pretty well known by people, and we'll talk about that in a minute as well. But for those of you maybe are not familiar with Mark's backstory, he was the evangelism director at Willow Creek Community Church in Chicago for 7 years, and for the Willow Creek Association for about a decade. You're not that old, are you?
I guess. I am.
Oh, that's okay. Well, sorry.
I really am.
Okay. Well, you're also a frequent contributor to Outreach Magazine, and you've been an editorial consultant. As a matter of fact, you worked as a periodic guest as also for this series that we've featured here at Stand to Reason before, called Faith Under Fire with Lee Strobel. So that's kind of cool. And then just if I can go back and look at your pedigree. You always got to examine pedigree. Here. You got your undergraduate degree in business. You have a master's degree in philosophy of religion from Trinity Evangelical Divinity School. And that's not bad, is it? And you were recently honored by the conferring of a doctorate of divinity degree from SES, Southern Evangelical Seminary in Charlotte, North Carolina. So that gives you some pretty good pedigree, bud. You're actually a smart guy.
I try.
And a smart and a handsome guy. So here we are talking about, we got a chance to hang out in Plano, Texas, which is near Dallas, about a month ago, and we started talking a little bit about a new book that you wrote it sometime before that. You gave me a copy, though, about a month ago, called The Reason Why, and I thought we should come in and talk about this on the radio, because I think it's a lot of times we talk about apologetics and what resources would be helpful for our friends, and I thought this book was really a good book. The 10 Questions Christians Hope No One Will Ask is a great resource. But what I love about The Reason Why is it's a smaller text. So let's just start for a second, if I can, Mark, and talk about this more recent text, The Reason Why Faith Makes Sense, and how you got the idea to do it, what you wanted to accomplish with it.
Well, it comes from a classic book, as you indicated, called The Reason Why. It was actually, it's almost a stretch to use the term book, because it was kind of a booklet or almost a glorified tract. Okay. But here's the quick history on it, because it's pretty fascinating. A young man who was a aspiring businessman in New Zealand came to Christ through the preaching of R.A. Torrey, mm-hmm. who was a preaching partner of Dwight L. Moody. And this young man's name was Robert Laidlaw, came to Christ, got really serious about his faith. At the same time, he was building this phenomenal business, which is still going today, called the Farmers Company Retail Stores. It's sort of like the Macy's of New Zealand. But anyway, he comes to faith, and he decides he wants to try to share his faith with his employees, with family members, and so on. So he writes this little booklet in 1913, so we're 99 years out now, and it was called The Reason Why. And he thought, I'm going to go nuts, I'm going to print 5,000 of these, that'll last me a lifetime. Well, you can guess what happened. People snapped him up, said, wow, this is good. He had great illustrations to answer some of the hard questions, but more than that, to explain the logic of the gospel, what it really means, make it understandable how a man dying on a cross 2,000 years ago has anything to do with me today. He really did a great job with that. So he printed more and went through those and printed more, and it just kind of took off. And then World War One happened, and it became kind of a standard tool for soldiers, for outreach, evangelism purposes. Then World War Two. Long story short, up through about the 70s and 80s, when it kind of started fading, finally, about 50 million copies went into print. 50 million, which is, you know, more than Purpose-Driven Life.
I'm going to say that. Yeah, it is.
Or Da Vinci Code.
Yeah, you're right, right.
Probably about those two put together. It was just a phenomenon. But, you know, they were selling them for, you know, you buy 100 of them for really cheap and give them to all your friends and so on. So I ran into it around the time I came to Christ, and I just thought it was a brilliant little piece. And when I started at Willow Creek, Lee Strobel and I would do a weekly class, apologetics class, and we'd give them out afterwards. And we got a really positive response, but people more and more said, you know, this thing's a little outdated. The language doesn't really answer some of the questions people are asking now, almost a century later. I said, you know, someone's got to update that book. Well, that's always a dangerous thing to say.
Yeah, no doubt.
Because it, you know, finally I think God tapped on me and said, you do it. And that's what I did. And about a year ago, this came out. And about a fourth of what's in my new expanded book, which I just, the way I say it is, I recreated it for a new generation. And only about a fourth of it goes back to the original. Even that is updated quite a bit. The rest is my own apologetic and explanation of the gospel for, you know, this generation, kind of written in the tone and spirit of the original.
Right.
And the bottom line is it's an inexpensive, small, quick read book that you can give to your friends. Christians read it and say it really helped them clarify the central message of what they believe and why it's true. But then they say, you know, I'm going to give it to other people. And it's cool. In the last couple of months, I've had several people write and talk about friends or relatives who have come to Christ through Lee Strobel, a guy who shovels his driveway. You may have heard this in Dallas.
No, I didn't.
Guy that shovels his driveway, Lee's been witnessing to him, inviting him to the church we're part of in Denver. And he's been coming on and off. And then Lee gave him his little book, because this was around Easter time, gave him Case for Easter.
Right.
And the guy read it and he said, well, that was really good. Starting to make sense. What else you got? And he goes, well, my ministry partner, Mark Middleberg, wrote this book called The Reason Why. Why don't you read that? And he did, and he got to the page that you've seen toward the end of the book, where I really do kind of an old-fashioned altar call in the book.
Yes. Yeah.
Where I present the gospel and say, you can right now pray this prayer, sign on the dotted line. Well, he got to that page, he prayed the prayer, and he signed on the dotted line. And it was just so cool to see how God worked again, using the power of the gospel, but through the human means of Lee and me and our church. And
yeah, no doubt. Now, was this the page, you know, the idea of a praying the prayer and having is that part of the original track? Was that part of the original approach?
It was.
And did you want to? Is that why you honored it, kind of left it in? Or do you think also, I think sometimes as apologists, we do a good job at making defenses for what we believe, but we don't sometimes go the entire, you know, 10 yards and ask the questions that need to be asked to get people to commit.
Yeah, I agree. And the answer is yes, it was a both and. Sort of to honor the original, but if I felt it wasn't appropriate, I would have changed that. I changed other things.
Sure.
But more than that, I really believe that as apologists, as evangelicals, that so often, especially in today's culture that is so anti-persuasion, quote-unquote proselytizing people, that I think we pull our punches. We kind of talk around and we give reasons, we give answers and say, gee, you know, hope someday you'll think about this. Mm-hmm. And I think we need to go back to the R.A. Torreys and the Dwight L. Moody's and, you know, the guys that had the guts to say, you know what, this is true.
Yeah.
And I've given you reasons. Why don't you know, is there any reason you wouldn't want to receive Christ right now? And you know what? When we do that, a lot of times people go, I'm ready. And in fact, I have a short story. I don't know if we have time for this.
Yeah, of course we do.
Early on, going back to that class I mentioned that Lee Strobel and I taught for a couple of years at Willow Creek, it was called the Foundations class. We'd do about 20 minutes of apologetics usually end with the gospel and then do Q&A, but often give people a chance to receive Christ. Around that time, this is like early 90s, there was a woman who started coming to our class, and we were so honored to have her there because it was Marie Little, the widow of the infamous Paul Little that wrote the classic books, Know What You Believe, Know Why You Believe, How to Give Away Your Faith. I mean, great, great books.
So why was she coming?
Well, her husband, Paul, had died back in the 70s. She lived in the Chicago area. She's an evangelist herself. Oh, cool. She had been a missionary in China mm-hmm. during the Chinese Revolution and barely got out. Just a delightful lady that loves the Lord, loves, you know, sharing the love of Christ with people who are far from him. And so she was attracted to the evangelism, what we were doing. She started coming to our classes, kind of became a groupie. But it was just so cool to have this woman there.
Yeah, absolutely.
And she was so encouraging. But one time, here's the point of the story. One time she came up to Lee and me after one of the classes. She said, I've figured out the secret to your success. You know, why you guys are successful, why God uses you, and so on. I went, oh, really? Cool.
Yeah.
What do we do? And she said, you guys are just dumb enough to get to the point, present the gospel, and give people a chance to respond.
And interesting.
I went, oh, thanks.
Yeah, you know, backhanded way.
I think that's a compliment.
Yeah.
But really, it was. It was. She said, you guys are smart. You give good answers. You give good talks, et cetera. But the power, according to Romans 1:16, the power is the gospel message. You know, it's the power of God unto salvation to everyone who believes, first to the Jew, then to the Greek, as it says in Romans 1:16. That's where the power is. And I think in apologetics, for any of us that are out, you know, giving answers, sharing our faith, I like what Josh McDowell said years ago. I think it was in his Evidence That Demands a Verdict book. He said, give just enough apologetics to clear the obstacles and then get back to the point. The point is the gospel. Jesus died on the cross for your sins. You need to receive his forgiveness, and you can do that right now.
Yeah, you know, for a lot of people who listen to us today, maybe they're just kind of surfing the channels and they've bumped across in America, wherever they are. They're listening to the station maybe for the first time or this show for the first time. Maybe you haven't even considered apologetics or the defending the faith or learning to defend the faith. For them, maybe they're hearing that and saying, well, of course that's true. Of course that's – but for a lot of us who have become avid defenders of the faith, I think we lose sight of that. I think that we have we've embraced the defense, the arguments to defend the faith as though they're the gospel, as though they're the most important things.
Yeah.
And that's – I think it's a weakness that we have as –
It's funny you say. I'm actually teaching tomorrow at Biola for a doctoral class, and I've done this with Dr. Michael Wilkins before, and he said this. He said a lot of people in apologetics kind of become professional academics. They're professional answer people. They dig truth. They love reading books. They love, but a lot of them have never really. And this amazed me. But he said a lot of them have never really attached that to the idea of evangelism.
Yeah.
Which just floored me because I thought, why do all that? I mean, to me, the motivation, the driving force, the fuel for apologetics is reaching people for Christ, leading them to Christ, using the answers to clear the obstacles so they can come to the cross of Christ. And I really think that should be the driving motivation for all of us.
I wonder, too, if when we train ourselves as apologists, do we spend the time to train ourselves as evangelists? Or have we really kind of compartmentalized the two different disciplines where we say there's evangelists and there are apologists and these don't kind of mix, you know, they're two different things.
Apparently some people do. I can't even divide the two really in my own mind because the two go so hand in hand. I mean, the old classic phrase is that apologetics is the handmaiden to evangelism. And that's really how I see it. Even though I probably spend more of my time now studying and writing and speaking on apologetics, the goal, the real, I mean, if you ask me at base,
right,
who am I, what am I about? It's evangelism, and that's apologetics is a tool for that purpose. Ultimately, we want to lead people into the kingdom.
Is that in part, though, Mark, because you had a background as a pastor before you started working as an apologist? Is that where that comes from?
I don't think so, because I was kind of doing apologetics before I was a pastor. So
okay.
But it just, for me, I don't know. It's maybe just how God geared me. But at the very beginning, when I first came to Christ, I was 19 years old, living off in the hinterlands, up in the tundra of North Dakota. And yet, in Minot, North Dakota, and yet God exposed me to so many isms and cults and world religions. I mean, I'm meeting Baha'is, and, you know, people in North Dakota never heard of a Baha'i.
Yeah.
And, you know, of course, Jehovah's Witnesses, Mormons, you know, standard agnostic skeptics. But what God did, and again, I was just a baby Christian. I didn't know what I was talking about, but I would meet these people, and I was immediately motivated. I remember with the Baha'i thing. Well, I had a copy of Walter Martin's Kingdom of the Cults. Well, he had a chapter on it. I didn't even know how to pronounce Baha'u'llah or any of that stuff at that time. But it was when I met this girl at a shopping mall and got in a spiritual conversation with her and cared about her and her soul that then I was motivated to read the chapter on Baha'ism from Walter Martin. And that then, you know, I kind of got geared up and understood and knew what they were about. And then I began to witness it to her. And years later, when I went to Trinity, I ended up visiting the Baha'i Temple and witnessing the tour guides there and so on. But it started for me, and I want to promote this. It was a concern for the spiritual welfare of a girl who happened to be caught up in Baha'ism. And I think, so for me, that was always the motivation. And I think to the degree we can keep that motivation, and then do our high-level studies and apologetics and speaking and so on. But always, that's one of the things I love about my kind of my apologetics hero is William Lane Craig, is that, yes, he is just a world-class, scary, smart debater.
Right. Yeah, we all feel that way. We're all intimidated by Bill Craig.
Oh, he's unbelievable. But he's also on staff for Campus Crusade for Christ. True. And at the end of every debate, every talk I've ever heard him give, he gives a simple testimony. In essence, you know, Jesus loves me, this I know.
Yeah.
And ends up saying, you can know this Jesus too. And I think Bill is modeling. I mean, he has the high level smarts and rationale and arguments and all that. But he keeps rooted in the gospel and the desire to lead people to Christ.
And so is that, it seems to me in many ways that is what distinguishes The Reason Why from other apologetics books, which are sometimes just a series of answers. This is a collection of answers en route to a question for commitment. These are a series of answers that seem to be shaped because they're heading towards something. And very briefly, I wanted to ask you before we go to the break, what's great about the book is it's extremely accessible and extremely brief. And what I mean by that, what's great about that is that I've noticed this, and maybe you have too. We're in a world right now of Twitter, mm-hmm. of, you know, 140 characters, of, you know, a paragraph at best. Every objection that's leveled at the gospel seems to be 140 characters. And if you can't provide a response that's equally rhetorically powerful in that short little 140 character box, you're just out of luck.
Yeah.
And they're not going to give you much more time than that. So in the past, you know, when I've got a website too where you've got a 14-page dissertation on objection X, most people aren't going to read past the first paragraph anymore.
That's right.
We've got to find a way to contextualize this stuff and get it down into rhetorical sound bites that are powerful. And that's what I think is great about any effort like The Reason Why, which it tries to take the big questions. And I'm just going to read some of the chapter distinctions here. Is there a God? Can the Bible be trusted? Are we accountable to God? Who was Jesus and what was his purpose? Is divine forgiveness available? What do I need to do? That's a great one. And then finally, of course, a place to put your decision, all those kinds of things are in here. And all of this takes place in a book that it's about the size of almost like an index card. You know, it's like almost a wallet size.
Yeah, you can put it in your back pocket.
You can put it in your back pocket.
It's short enough you can read on a flight from L.A. to Chicago, you know.
Yeah, right.
And that really was the intention, to keep it readable, like you say, to try to give really good answers, but in a concise form. And like the defense of the Bible, I think that whole apologetic is in bullet point form. I think it's about 2 pages.
Right.
Now, obviously, there's a lot more that can and sometimes needs to be said, and I point to other books and resources.
Right.
But I think the average person they need, you know, give it to me, boom, boom, boom. Oh, wow, that's good answer. Okay, what's next?
Right.
And I don't think most people really need a big tome on it.
Yeah, I think sometimes we assume that we have a 15-page objection. when someone gives us the 140 character objection, and we assume, okay, this is the tip of an iceberg, and I need to get into an iceberg kind of response.
Yeah.
And when really all people have is a tip of a question, and then once you've overcome it, they're ready to go on to the next issue, whatever that may be. And so what's nice about the reason why faith makes sense is that it really does try to navigate across those tips and then points you in the direction to get bigger answers, and that's I think some of the great value of your book. But let's take a break right now. We're up at our first break for this hour, and when we come back, I want to talk to you a little bit about your personal background leading up to this, and talk about other works you've done, including the questions Christians hope no one will ask, which I've always thought that was a great title for a book. We'll come back and do that in 2 minutes here on Stand to Reason.
Did God really say it's the oldest temptation in human history, one that targets the authority of God's word at its very foundation? Its modern rephrasing takes many forms, both in academia and in popular culture. Are the New Testament documents reliable? Have ancient biblical books been lost or suppressed by the early church? Are the words of the Bible just flawed human inventions? These questions introduce doubt at the point of contact between God and man, undermining the Christian's confidence in the words of Scripture. Even those secure in their affirmation of divine authorship must wrestle with similar questions. Did God really say to me? In other words, do the promises of Scripture apply to the individual Christian's life today or only to those originally addressed? How is one to understand and apply these biblical assurances? In this timely collection of essays called Ancient Words, Reflections on the Reliability and Proper Use of Scripture, Greg carefully addresses each of these issues, providing both solid evidence for the reliability of Scripture and a clear roadmap for how it should be read and applied. Greg's responses to these popular challenges to biblical authority will help reinforce your confidence in this trustworthy book. Go to Stand to Reason's online store at www.str.org and get a copy of Ancient Words, or call 1-800-2-REASON.
Is there ever a right time to judge? What did Jesus mean when he said, "Do not judge so that you will not be judged"? I'm Brett Kunkel, and you can hear the answer to this question on my Bulletproof podcast this month. Download Bulletproof from iTunes or the podcast page at str.org.
Did you know that nearly a billion cell phones were sold last year? And every year, 500 million obsolete cell phones gather dust in desk drawers or end up in landfills. I want to tell you how you can transform your unused cell phone and even your used car from a natural hazard into ministry impact to equip Christian ambassadors by donating them to Stand to Reason. Old cars and cell phones can be turned into radio time, podcasts, and other training resources that can build a whole new generation of ambassadors for Jesus Christ. Think of it. Because of your donation, Christians just like you will be able to effectively share their faith and change the lives of others forever. Now, to donate your old car or cell phone, just call iDonate at 877-897-4273 or visit iDonate.com and search for Stand to Reason. They'll take care of everything for you and STR. Not only can you donate old cars and cell phones, but iDonate can help you with all kinds of non-cash donations for STR. Just call them at 877-897-4273 or visit iDonate.com. And thanks so much for making Stand to Reason's work possible.
We are ambassadors for Christ. That's what Paul tells us in 2 Corinthians 5:20. An effective ambassador has three essential skills. First, an ambassador must have the basic knowledge necessary for his task. Second, this knowledge must be deployed in a skillful way. There's an element of wisdom, a tactical and artful diplomacy that makes his message persuasive. Third is character. His personal maturity and individual virtue will either make or break his message. Stand to Reason's mission is to help you develop the foundational skills in each one of these areas. In Essential Ambassador Skills, Greg Kunkel will train you in all three of these areas to be an effective ambassador for Christ and to represent God's message of grace in a broken world. To order this unique message, call 1-800-2-REASON or go to our website, str.org. 800-2-REASON or str.org to order Essential Ambassador Skills by Greg Kunkel.
So glad to be with you today here. I'm Stand to Reason. Jay Warner Wallace sitting in for Greg Kunkel. Taking a stand for the things that matter most in life and trying our best to look at life right side up with our guest, Mark Middleberg, who you probably know from his work in apologetics, writing as an author, as a pastor, and as a ministry partner with Lee Strobel. As a matter of fact, I was going to talk to you a little bit, Mark, about an event coming up in October By the way, I've tweeted out in our hashtag STR Talks, I've tweeted out a location online which you can get sample chapters for both The Reason Why and for the Questions Christians Hope No One Will Ask. Both books have sample chapters online. If you go to Twitter on the hashtag STR Talk, I'll give you a location there. I'll also give you a location for what you're about to talk about right now, which is an event you're hosting in October. Tell us about that.
Yeah, I'm really excited about this. Lee Strobel and I, one of the things we do in our ministry partnership besides write and go out and speak live is we do some simulcasts that any church anywhere can sign up for and broadcast into their church, live video, high def, you know, really high quality stuff. But this one is really special. It's going to be on Sunday evening, October 14th, live. And the title is Unpacking Atheism. And it's going to be Lee Strobel and myself hosting it, but our guest is the man we just talked about, Dr. William Lane Craig, the man who's debated virtually every famous atheist in the world, at least the ones that have the courage to face him. And he wins, and he's powerful, and he's going to give some of his best arguments. But more than that, he's going to tell some fascinating stories about his debates, his encounters with, you know, the Christopher Hitchens of the world, the Richard Dawkinses of the world, Sam Harris and others. He's debated most or all of these people. And so we're going to unpack that, unpack atheism. And it's something you can bring your non-Christian friends to. It won't just be stories. It'll be content. It'll be what do atheists believe and how do we answer them, but also some high-level stories. And we'll also have some special guests that will talk about their background in atheism. A friend of mine named Randall Niles, who's
right, yeah,
got a ministry called allaboutgod.com.
Mm-hmm. And about 1,000 different websites, too, it seems like.
Yes, well, he really does. And he's a former atheist and a lawyer.
From
and
here
so,
in California, as a matter of fact.
Originally,
there, yeah.
Now he's
right.
In Colorado,
that's
where
right.
Lee and I are. So he's going to tell his story, and we'll probably have one or two other special guests. But anyway, it's October 14th, and your church can broadcast that live, and I think we'll have some Q&A. You can send in questions, but it's a powerful two-hour event and one you can open up to your entire community, invite other churches, but more than that, invite non-Christians. It'll be done in a way that's appropriate for anyone to come and hear the truth of the gospel and how Christianity trumps atheism.
Yeah, and you've got actually on the Unpacking Atheism section of incastevents.com. I've just linked to it on Twitter, so you can all check it out. There's a promotional video with you and Lee talking about this event. And it is true, isn't it, that for the most part, William Lane Craig has established not only the reliability and power of the evidence for Christianity, but he has established himself as a force to be contended with, and I don't know many people on the other side who want to debate him anymore.
Well, and this is part of the story we'll tell that night, but I'll give a little preview, and that's that last October he did a tour of the UK.
Right.
And he speaks and debates all over the world. He goes on debate tours where he'll debate like 10 of the top atheists in 2 weeks. I mean, it's just mind-boggling. But anyway, he was going to the UK, and a bunch of the Christians there said, well, look, we'll try yet again to see if the famous, infamous Richard Dawkins, the author of The God Delusion and The Blind Watchmaker, et cetera, you know, this famous militant atheist, see if he'll have the willingness, the courage to debate William Lane Craig. Well, he refused yet again. He's steadfastly refused for years. And he's given about 12 contradictory reasons why he won't debate
right, why he won't do it,
Bill
yeah.
Craig. But here's what's so cool, and we'll probably show pictures of this that night. But a couple of years ago, the atheists in the UK ran a campaign where they put big signs on the sides of the double-decker buses all over London that said, there's probably no God.
Right.
So enjoy your life, you know, get on with it. Well, when Dawkins refused to debate William Lane Craig last October, the Christians thought, well, we could have some fun with this. So they bought signs for the double-decker buses in London that said, there's probably no Dawkins.
Right. Yeah, that was perfect.
And then it said, but come to the Sheldonian Theater anyway and hear William Lane Craig. And then they had an open invitation. They had a table with a name tag that said Richard Dawkins and a chair and a mic for him. They said, if you decide you're willing, we'll you come and, you know, we invite you still. But if you don't come, he's going to pick apart your book, The God Delusion, and that's what ended up happening. And
right. He actually did an event in which he just addressed the book.
Yeah, and yeah. tore it apart. But yeah. anyway, so those are some of the amazing things happening. You know, so many Christians, they go to, you know, a secular university, and they have this professor that's so cocky and wise and, you know, ridicules the faith of Christians. Well, those are the very guys that William Lane Craig's debating.
Absolutely.
And showing how foolish their arguments are.
And I think most of the kind of the four horsemen of the new atheists have all except for Dawkins have well, even Dawkins had gotten involved in a kind of a debate, and I think it was in Mexico at a conference where it was not a one-on-one, though. It was like a panel debate.
It was, and he didn't know that Craig was going to be
right.
there, so he kind of got backed into it. But
yeah.
but it's really interesting. You know, I probably enjoy some of this more than I should, but it's
even watching Sam Harris in the last debate with him, he had admitted that most of his peers are absolutely steadfastly afraid to even
trembling. Yeah.
Yeah.
But again, I just want to encourage our listeners, you can do this, and maybe you don't have the authority to decide for your church, but write down that link, take it to your pastor or whoever's in charge of your outreach or special events, and sit down with them, show them the website, let them watch it's like a 2 or 3 minute video of Lee Strobel and me standing in my front yard in Colorado with moths flying in our faces as we were trying to do this video. But, you know, come show it to them and say, look, this is something, and there's a moderate cost, but it's an easy thing any church can do. It's kind of plug and play, show it and promote it. In fact, they'll even have free downloadable promotional materials, but it's an easy thing any church anywhere. My church in Minot, North Dakota is doing it, and if they're doing it, you can do it.
Well, it seems to me that might be the future of how we I just came back from a conference yesterday, and it's logistically difficult, it seems to me, to get apologists all over the country. We're doing it, though, as churches are hosting conferences of one nature or another. And sometimes when you go to these conferences, Mark, you if you're in the Q&A, people will ask. The conference is either full of people who are already interested in apologetics or have become interested as a result of going to the conference. And the question I get asked a lot is, you know, how do I get on a path to either be more effective as a personal apologist, or how do I take this avocational interest we talked about it last hour, and you know, Frank Turk's got CIA, Instructors Academy, everyone's got some way to help us get in the game. I'd be curious to know your personal story and your kind of your path toward being a person now who is one of the people we rely on as an apologetics resource. How did you get from A to Z? How did you get from starting, and I'd just be curious in your own personal history, how you, your journey, basically.
Well, I hinted at it already, and that is School of Hard Knocks. I mean, seriously, I just came to Christ and started sharing my faith, and then encountering. If you get active talking to enough people about Christ, you're going to encounter all kinds of questions and objections and, you know, isms and other religions and other belief systems. And that's what happened to me. And that's a healthy thing. And it's, you know, we tell people this all the time, but I just got to say it again. It's okay to just look at the person and say, I have no idea how to answer that question. Or in the case of this girl, I'm going, how do you say it?
Yeah.
Baha'ism? What is that? Well, I let her educate me first, and she told me about Baha'u'llah, this guy who was supposed to be the fulfillment of, you know, the return of Christ. And she kind of gave me their whole spiel. Well, I listened respectfully, and I said, well, that's really interesting. I don't think I see it the way you do, but, I'm going to study this. And she's okay. And so we said, let's get together again. Then I got the Walter Martin chapter, read up, talked to some people. I was mentored by, I don't know if you know the names, Bob and Gretchen Passantino out here in Southern California.
I don't know. No, sorry.
But they've mentored a lot of people, and they've helped write books with Norman Geisler and Josh McDowell and Hank Hanegraaff, on and on and on. But so I had go-to people that I would say, well, give me, you know, what chapter should I read or what book should I get? But School of Hard Knocks is really a great place to start. But then beyond that, yeah, to take advantage of ministries like you mentioned, Frank's, near where I live now in the Denver area, it's actually in Colorado Springs, Summit Ministries.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm.
Tremendous. And both of my kids have gone through there. It's for like older high school, younger college age students. It's a 10-day camp basically in Manitou Springs, which is sort of a suburb of Colorado Springs, and tremendous place to hear J.P. Moreland and Frank Turek and Sean McDowell and me and a bunch of people that come through there every year. And
Brett actually was telling me yesterday that he had your daughter in one of his classes that he was teaching, I guess maybe a couple of years ago.
Yeah, last summer.
Okay, yep. Yeah. So
that's a tremendous place. But then I would just add, there's some powerful programs. One, well, it's part of what I'm speaking for tomorrow. Biola has a world-class apologetics and philosophy of religion program. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, that's another option. Or SES in Charlotte, or Liberty in Virginia has some great professors. And now some things starting in Houston at the Baptist deal there where Mike Lacone is gone. There's more and more of these programs starting. Oh, and right where I'm from, Doug Grotheis in Denver Seminary.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And he's really started a new apologetics program there. But you can sign up, especially if you already have your college degree. You can do some of these things in, you know, a year and a half or so. And it's not that hard, but you learn a lot from world-class teachers.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, so just tell me on your own journey, though, when did you become a Christian? Or pretty early on, it sounds like.
Well, I grew up in a strong Christian home. I'm like the opposite of Lee Strobel's story. You know, I grew up in a strongly evangelical home. I actually prayed with my mom to ask Jesus into my heart when I was 4 years old.
Wow.
You know? But I was in one of those situations where, you know, a Baptist church where, you know what's right and then you don't do it and you backslide. And then every summer you go to camp and throw a log in the fire and get saved again.
Yeah, got it. Okay.
I had those roller coaster up and down spiritual experiences all through junior high and high school. And mostly in high school, I was a prodigal son. Not in the sense that I ran away from home, but I ran away spiritually. And I was, you know, just living kind of a typical partying lifestyle and just not following God till age 19. And I actually write about this in the couple of the books, actually. I was challenged by a guy I had gone to high school with a year earlier when we were in school, and he just basically called me on the carpet for claiming to be a Christian but really being a hypocrite, and he was right. And so that kind of made me mad at first, but it made me think. And a week later, age 19, November 8th, 1976, way back. See, I am old.
You're actually older than me, so I can feel good about that.
But anyway, that night I went to this Bible study I'd been visiting a few times. Afterwards, I prayed. I just said, God, from here on out, I'm tired of playing games. I'm tired of these ups and downs. From here on out, I want to follow you. I want to serve you. I want to be used by you. Take my life. And he did, and he forgave me. And I got to say, and in fact, Lee Strobel and I wrote a book together called The Unexpected Adventure.
Right. I didn't mention that. I wanted to mention that. That's actually one of the things I wanted to talk about.
Well, and I just got to say, that was the thing. I always resisted following Christ because, like, that's when the fun stops.
Yeah,
that's
right.
That's what I thought. Of course, that's what the devil whispers in our ears. The truth, the real truth, is just the opposite. It's when I quit screwing around trying to act cool at parties and pretend and all that, and it's when the real adventure of being on a mission from God, you know, you say that in the movie, but it's true. You when you follow Christ, you get put on secret missions. You get used by the Almighty, the God of the universe, speaking through me and impacting lives and eternities through me. Man, Jim, I'll tell you, I spoke at my hometown, I mentioned it a few times, up in North Dakota. I was there about a month ago, and I spoke for a Christian school there, and kind of a fundraiser deal. But a woman I'd had the privilege of leading to Christ just a couple of years after I first came to Christ came up to me. I hadn't seen her for more than a decade, probably actually about 20 years. She's still walking with Christ today. And it's had real ups and downs, but she's walking solid with Christ. Her name's Carla. She comes up, gives me a hug, then introduces me to her daughter, a high school, I think, senior. And then after we'd talked a few minutes, Carla and her mom were there. They walked away, and the daughter kind of snuck back over to me, real shy, and she said, "I just want to thank you for the impact you've had on my mom's life."
Wow.
And she's just shy about it. And I just said, "Oh, well, thank you. That really means a lot." And I gave her a hug and she walked away.
But how old was her daughter?
The daughter was, I think, a senior in high school.
Okay.
But her mom went through some addictions and had to go through treatment. But I look back and I say, that's adventure. I mean, this Carla, the mom who I helped lead to Christ, I met her when I was selling electronics in an electronics store. I sold her a car stereo, got into a spiritual conversation, ended up spending time with her and praying with her to receive Christ back in the late 70s, early 80s. And here I am, you know, last month, her daughter giving me a hug and thanking me for the impact it's had.
And undoubtedly, her daughter was raised under the influence of that mom who had that experience. And so she's also a product of that entire adventure.
Yeah, and she's seen the struggles, but she's seen the difference sure. Christ has made. And so I just say to folks, you know, not that everyone's called to be an evangelist, but we're all called to be used by God. We're all on a mission. And Rick talks about we all have a purpose.
Yeah.
And we do. And, man, that's where the adventure is.
No doubt about it. Now, we're going to take a break, come back. And what I want to do when we come back is imagine that we have people who are launching questions at you, the big questions that Christians hope no one will ask. Maybe take one or two of these out of your book, maybe the big ones, and talk about how we can best respond to those. And we'll do that right after the break here on Stand to Reason.
Call today to request the latest issue of Solid Ground, our bi-monthly newsletter. This free publication is filled with practical information and useful tools to help you represent your faith, even when discussing the most timely and heated subjects like evolution, cloning, stem cell research, and doctor-assisted suicide. In each issue of Solid Ground, Greg Kokel will teach you how to represent your faith as an ambassador for Christ in a concise and attractive manner. So contact us today at 1-800-2-REASON. That's 1-800, the number 2, and the word reason. Or visit us on the web at www.str.org to request our newsletter, Solid Ground. We'll send it to you absolutely free when you call 1-800-2-REASON or visit str.org.
Do you want to know the one question I ask same-sex marriage advocates when they claim that homosexuals don't have equal protection under the law? To find out what it is, download my podcast, Thinking Out Loud, from iTunes or the podcast page at str.org.
In the United States, over 51 million abortions have been performed since it was legalized in 1973. That's one abortion every 26 seconds. If you have been wanting to be able to speak out effectively against abortion, or just be better prepared to discuss this often heated and always emotional topic, STR has a great resource to help equip you to do that. Stand to Reason Interactive, Making Abortion Unthinkable, prepares you for any pro-life encounter, from one-on-one discussions to a public debate, with the confidence that your case is solid, your knowledge deep, and your argument just. Created to be used as a personal study or in a small group setting in your church or home, this easy-to-follow, well-reasoned, plug-and-play course provides the basic training for anyone to become proficient in the art of pro-life persuasion. Through video, workbooks, role-playing, and quizzes, Making Abortion Unthinkable will prepare you to restore meaning to the word abortion using compelling visual aids. Simplify the abortion issue by focusing on one strategic question. Present scientific evidence to offer a sound, reasonable, and persuasive argument. Expose the four common flaws of pro-abortion rhetoric. Clear the red herring objections and stay on course. Be respectful toward the person you're talking with. If you haven't yet taken a stand against abortion, call Stand to Reason today at 1-800-2-REASON. That's 1-800-2-REASON, or visit us on the web at str.org.
Wow, we're finishing up our third hour on this beautiful Sunday, and we're sitting with Mark Middleberg, the author of The Reason Why, Faith Makes Sense, a book we've talked about in the last few minutes. And also, we're going to launch into a book that's a little bit older, but I think is a great opportunity for people to kind of, and the title of the book, I hope that the title served you well. I bet it probably did.
It creates a lot of intrigue.
Yeah. And you
Lee
see
Strobel
it
came up with the title.
Really? Well, it's a great idea because it just sits there. It's on white background. The questions Christians hope no one will ask. And it does cover a lot of questions, I think, that we get on this radio show. Sometimes people will call with some of these questions. So I want to just leave it out to you. We've got if you've got a few minutes left, it's 15 minutes or so. And I wanted to be able to kind of maybe go through some of the, and I thought maybe you would maybe pick the ones that have been the most challenging, or maybe you've heard the most often. You've got them in a certain order. I wasn't sure if the order you put them in was because you saw this is the first and most frequent thing you're going to get, or what order you put them in.
Yeah, it just to respond to that quickly, it was not in the order of, you know, this is all based on a survey we did through George Barna. In fact, David Kinnaman did the survey. And these are the top 10 questions that came up from 1,000 Christians saying, here's what I hope people won't bring up.
It's a great, great premise. Now, I can't remember. Did you actually commission that work before you started? Or did you just see? Okay.
Yeah. And,
got it.
But I couldn't put it in the order of biggest because there's sort of a flow. For instance, if you're going to talk about who is Jesus, it's better to talk about the Bible first and so forth.
Yep. So tell me, what do you think of these questions as the one that is the most pressing that you got? Let's just start from the hardest. And the questions that Christians hope no one will ask because it's the most difficult question to navigate.
Well, let me just tell you, the two biggest ones were the first and last that I addressed in the book. First one is, how do you know God exists?
Right. Now,
so many of us just grew up accepting that, being told, of course, God exists. So we just haven't thought about, how do I prove, you know, that my invisible Savior is real when I can't see him, touch him, feel him, you know, point to him? So that's a big one. The other one isn't as much hard, but just a lot of curiosity, and that's about heaven and hell, really. But a lot of questions about heaven and what is heaven and how do we know it's real and so forth.
And I thought that was curious when I saw it. I always thought that the opposite would be true, that people would be more perplexed and troubled by the existence and nature of hell.
Frankly, I wish more people were.
Yeah, no kidding.
But a lot more curiosity. Part of it is I have the survey numbers in there. I think it's like 40 times as many people think they're going to heaven than hell. So
maybe
hell
that's
seems,
what it is.
Hell seems irrelevant to
so
them.
It's almost like we're such a myopic, rather self-indulgent culture that we're really more concerned with the thing we think we're going to get anyway than the thing we fear not. You know, we might be getting, and don't want to think bad about those kinds of things.
And that's true, but at the same time, the way I try to answer the heaven question points to the reality of both, and that is just in a nutshell, my apologetic on that is I say we do not have the kinds of empirical data and evidence you can have for the resurrection or for other questions that come up. But what we do have is a credible source, an incredibly credible source named Jesus, who had the credentials. And he talked about what is real concerning heaven and hell, both, in that they are real places that real people go to. And here's what he taught, and here's the basis for how you know which one you're headed toward and how to change that course if you're headed the wrong way. So I really lean on the authority and testimony of Christ primarily. I give a few other arguments, but I think the strong one is really Jesus.
And I think it's why you order these chapters in the way you did, because really in order to lean on the testimony of Christ, you've got to make a credible case for Jesus first.
You're right. Which is another one of the big chapters. I think that was the question three, if I remember right. Mm-hmm. But so many people today say, you know, you guys have kind of invented a story around this man named Jesus. He was a good guy. He was a good teacher, but this idea that he was the Son of God and that you would worship him. In fact, I've actually heard people say this, you know, if Jesus knew today you guys are worshiping him, he'd roll over in his grave.
Oh, jeez.
And I say, well, you've kind of missed a newsflash.
Yeah, no kidding.
He's not in his grave anymore.
Yeah.
And furthermore, and then I give in that chapter, I give just a wealth of evidence, historical evidence, biblical evidence, and so on, that it's very clear, not only that he made the claim to deity, but it was predicted in the Old Testament. It's part of the prophecies of the Messiah. He was worshipped at his birth. He was worshipped throughout his life. At the very end of his ministry, Thomas realizes he had really risen from the dead, John 20:28, my Lord and my God. And Jesus blesses him for that testimony. So it's very clear that the deity of Christ is very clear. Maybe I should back up to the one I already mentioned. You know, how do you know God exists at all?
Right. Well, before we go back to that for a second, though, I thought what was interesting, too, you just said about Jesus being worshipped. And it, to me, what's powerful about that, too, is the idea that we're – this is in a culture – in which the Jews surrounded him in his own context of his own beliefs, it was clear that only one God should be worshipped. And every other example of a New Testament character, be it Peter or Paul or whoever, who somebody ends up worshipping, that person says, get up. I'm not God. I'm only a man. Jesus never makes statements like that. He simply accepts the act of worship.
Yeah.
So let's go back to this idea about – I noticed you talk a little bit about causality in that chapter. You talk a little bit about fine-tuning, a just-so universe in that chapter. So
the existence of God.
Yeah.
Yes.
So you kind of go through some of the
scientific.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And as opposed to, we do this as evidentialists. We're looking at this room of the universe and trying to decide if there's any evidence in it for somebody outside this universe having entered. And so you looked at issues of causality, you looked at issues of fine-tuning. What do you make of the challenges we're seeing now sometimes about causality and fine-tuning that come from multiverse theory? This is a challenge I think a lot of people throw at us that wants to, and in the effort, I think, on the part of skeptics is to kind of wipe away some of the foundational evidence which we have been using from the cosmological argument, from the anthropic principle, get rid of it.
You're right that they come up with stories. That's my mentor, Bob Pasentino, said anyone can tell a story.
Exactly, yeah.
And that's exactly the multiverse deal. There's no evidence for it. It's just a way of kind of making it hard to argue with because they say, well, what if we have, you know, almost an infinite number of universes? Chances are one of them would end up like this one, and we got lucky. We're in the one that supports life. Well, okay, wait a minute. First of all, do you have any evidence for all these universes? This is just a story.
Sometimes the evidence just seems to be marked that we're in a universe that appears to be fine-tuned. That's all the evidence. I mean, since this clearly cannot happen by design.
Right. What it shows is an anti-supernatural presupposition.
There you go.
It's a big mouthful, but it means a bias. You're prejudiced against the idea of God or the supernatural, so you're willing to take this blind leap of faith into some fantastic story. It's great science fiction, but this idea that there's infinite number of universes and we just got lucky and we're in the one. I mean, man, this makes the lottery look like a sure bet. You know?
Yeah.
And furthermore, if there were an infinite number of universes, you go back to the whole causality deal. There must be an incredible cause behind all these universes.
Yeah, it doesn't remove the idea that something came from nothing.
Yeah, so this whole argument that whatever has a beginning has a cause, and you know the universe had a beginning, therefore the universe has a cause outside of itself, a wise, eternal, you know, powerful cause that you know is God. Well, that argument just gets stronger with a multiverse. So this is really sort of a creative dodge and a story that gets made up and I think a blind leap of faith.
You know, I was talking with Jeff Swearink, who's part of Reasons.org with Hugh Ross, and he was talking about multiverse theory, making the same exact case, that actually in some ways it requires an even a greater, more powerful, the fine-tuning.
I don't have enough faith to believe that stuff.
Yeah, exactly.
And you know what? I'm really encouraged if Hugh Ross was saying what I'm saying or those guys, you know, those guys are so scary smart.
We talked about that earlier. And I always make the analogy, and maybe you would agree with me on this, and I think maybe Lee would too, is that, you know, in any courtroom setting, we have expert witnesses we bring in, and these guys are smart.
Oh, man.
These are the biologists, the DNA experts, the fingerprint forensic experts, and these are people who will go on and on if you let them in front of the jury. And I get more confused sitting there at the table than probably the jury is. And at some point, you've got to say, okay, time out. Ladies and gentlemen, this is what this means.
It's funny you say that. At Willow Creek, I brought Hugh Ross in once, and I stayed on stage with him, and we did Q&A, and he would give his answer, and then I would interpret
it. That's so funny, like a language interpreter.
Yeah. And I say, here's what he was trying to say in English.
Exactly.
But there was one time he gave an answer. I just looked at it. I go, yeah, whatever he said. I didn't get it either.
I know. That's always the problem. But what I love about it is I am encouraged, and I don't want to just default to authority. And that's, I think, what we see a lot of our skeptical friends will default to authority. I don't want to be in that same position where I say, well, look, you know, I don't get it, but there's a smarter guy than me sitting next to me who does, so I've got confidence it can be gotten. That though sometimes does give us a little bit of encouragement that there are people who are very familiar with the discipline, very familiar with the science, and are very and this is what's so great about William Lane Craig, isn't it?
Well, and not just William Lane. There's the Mike Laconas of the world.
Absolutely.
There's the Sean McDowell's doing debates now, and my friend Nabil Qureshi, a former Muslim. What I love about it is a lot of times these experts, these authorities, they sit in their little perch in their university setting or, you know, their blog or whatever, and surrounded by fans, and they sound like they really make sense and sound powerful until they face one of these really smart Christians. And then you start seeing how their arguments crumble.
Yeah.
And so I think that's the value of a debate, is that it really puts, you know, fire to it. It tests these ideas and to see what stands up. For instance, Richard Dawkins, you read his book, you know, The God Delusion. I mean, a lot of Christians are trembling by the end of reading that because he's so adamant and strong.
And persuasive in his rhetorical language.
Yeah, and condemning of the foolishness of religion. Mm-hmm. And same with Christopher Hitchens. But then you see a debate with these guys, or in the case of Dawkins, the lack of courage to have the debate with the really good. He'll debate some, you know, pastor or bishop or something that maybe isn't an expert in these areas. but he won't debate the real thinkers.
Right.
And you start finding out these guys, you know, I think Dawkins is probably a pretty good biologist, but he's a horrible philosopher.
Right. Oh, absolutely. A lot of these mistakes are being made in the area of philosophy.
Yeah. Well, and even the new Stephen Hawking's book, you know.
Oh, absolutely.
The Grand Design. I mean, Hawking's is a brilliant physicist, but he starts talking about philosophy, he gets foolish.
Yeah, and he does it right away in the first chapter.
The first page, he says philosophy is dead and science is how we now learn. Well, I just say to groups when I speak, I ask you, is that a philosophical statement or a scientific
exactly.
statement?
Exactly.
It is a philosophical statement telling us philosophy is dead. He has just self-refuted himself.
Yeah, and this is something that Greg's done a lot of work on this issue, too. And so it's one of those things. We have about a minute left, and I want to just make sure before I leave you today that we talk a little bit about what your efforts are going forward. You're here for a reason tonight. I happen to grab you while you're here to teach tomorrow at Biola. What are you teaching tomorrow? Is that something you do regularly?
Yeah, I do that. Tomorrow we're talking about back on the evangelism front. We're talking more about leadership and evangelism, how to help our churches be contagious,
awesome.
How to be churches that really reach people for Christ. And apologetics is one of the tools we're going to talk about. But old-fashioned evangelism training, having the courage to bring it up in a conversation, the clarity to talk about your story, how Christ has changed your life, you know, how to present the gospel in simple, understandable terms. Kind of goes back to a lot of what I taught in the Becoming a Contagious Christian course, which is still being used and taught in churches.
Oh, that's awesome. Well, Mark, I can tell you, you made an incredible contribution in that regard. That's where I think you have a unique lane to run in. I think that you've provided something that a lot of us as apologists have kind of, in some ways, compartmentalized ourselves out of what's really important. And your book, The Reason Why Faith Makes Sense, I think is an incredible contribution to that effort. I would suggest all of you, I've tweeted it now on our Twitter page, get over to STR Talk, hashtag STR Talk. You can see some sample chapters there as well. And Mark, thank you so much for coming in today.
Thank you, Jim.
Here. I appreciate it. And that's it for our show this week here at Stand to Reason. I appreciate Greg giving me the reins for a couple of weeks now, going back as he's been traveling. I'm so glad he's getting back home, because I think you guys want Greg back, I know. I'm happy to have him come back. So this week, get out there and give him heaven.
You've been listening to Stand to Reason. Our podcasts and radio program are made possible by friends of this ministry through their generous support. You can support STR by making a gift online at str.org.